The devil was part of the original creation, and if you believe in God, then you must believe in the devil. There are two influences. One for light, under which everything grows and blossoms, and one is darkness, in which everything decays and dies. And in any part of the world, within the year, the same hours of darkness and light supervene. And you have these two invisible influences striving for the soul of man. We don't know why, any more than we know what is eternity.
And you believe that light and darkness, right and left, good and evil, are two absolutely separate but
warring powers. And the devil is only just a name for power of evil.
You referred just now to invisible influences. I'm perhaps a bit of a cynic, and I tend not to believe in these sort of things. Why do you believe in them?
Well, one invisible influence is, for example, the influence of the moon on the tides. There is good reason to suppose that all planets have an influence on us. Hypnotism, which has been proved again and again, telepathy, which is beyond dispute now, dowsing for water, they are invisible influences.
So, it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On Friday the 22nd of September 2023, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stoke-on-Trent Arts Centre in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available with all good app stores, please, anything but Google. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda, the soil, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. Very much a theme of this week's show. Albert Pike's accelerationist strategy. It's clear to anyone with eyes to see and ears to hear the so-called solutions to every crisis, whether it's climate, migrant, COVID, economic, Ukraine, are not designed to make things better. As the mass media tries to spin them, they're Armageddonist policies designed to make every crisis worse. UN Sustainable Development Goals are supposed to address the climate crisis and world inequality, but are they really just a race to the bottom, undoing centuries of progress to try and bomb the developed world back to the Stone Age? Anyway, helping navigate us through the fourth right matrix, or the fourth industrial revolution of the good old World Economic Forum, it's our Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Part one this week, quite clearly having a good old look at Russell Brand. Interesting that the timing of why he has been outed with these accusations from many years ago. Also looking at Keir Starmer and some of the mythology around him when he first started. A couple of specials this week. Firstly, looking at the September the 11th attacks in part one. A chat with a guy called Matt Campbell, whose brother died in the September the 11th attacks. He's doing a special next weekend, not this weekend, next weekend up in London, screening the new film. And also he'll be hearing next week the results of the latest round to try and get justice for his brother and bring some of the evidence in front of the court about what really happened on the September the 11th attack. We've also got some various looks at the nuclear weapons this week. John Large talks about possible nuclear accidents that may take place and what might be the consequences for local people down at Devonport. John Large has now passed away, but he was one of the designers of the old Magnox reactors, who worked with the Fire Brigades Union on their nuclear policies. Fascinating chat. Also revisiting the Palomares incident, which I'm sure Martin remembers, or at least knows about, back in 1966, an American B-52 bomber with four nuclear bombs on it exploded over Spain and dropped it to the bombs all over the place. And there's still an enormous problem there on the ground with, because two of these bombs caught fire. Well, it exploded in a nuclear way, but the explosives in them went off. And it was basically what they call a dirty bomb. So France 24 have done a fantastic piece on that. Also, there's news this week about one of the things that prompted me to look into this is the atomic bomb tests. There is at least some of the veterans who are still alive, and relatives of those that died want proper compensation for those guinea pigs. Also, in part two, we'll have a look at the hit on Sevastopol today by NATO weapons hitting the headquarters of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. Now, this is a dispute that goes all the way back to Winston Churchill and the Crimean War. Now, at last, NATO's got its excuse to go bashing away at the Black Sea Fleet. We'll have a look at what has happened today and also why it is that the Anglo-Zionist Empire is so unhappy with this thing called the Russian Black Sea Fleet and what support it's giving, and where that power is projecting. So Yahoo's spectacular gaffe today at the United Nations, where he says it's a gaffe. Maybe it's just a little in-joke by the Israelis, where he's actually issued a nuclear threat to Iran at the United Nations on the podium, but he's later retracted saying, "Oh, sorry, I just misspoke. I said the wrong thing." If you can believe that, you believe anything. Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, then by Ofcom. Us cancelled, even off puny little Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but we're not cancelled here yet. So let's embark on another show. Martin, your thoughts about any of these, I mean, particularly about Keir Starmer this week. We're going to start by looking at a bit of his backstory. I noticed a few weeks ago that he was the lawyer in the Mac Libel trial, and I'm getting more and more suspicious about this guy. I remember years ago we were chatting with Annie Machon about Tony Blair, and the fact that when Dave Shaler and Annie first came out of MI5 blowing the whistle on the Gaddafi plot, he was I think it was Jonathan Hollow something or other. But anyway, he was through the Mail on Sunday, and he got summoned to Downing Street, taken by Blair into the garden. A very frightened Blair saying, "What does Shaler know about me? What does he know about my past?" Because, of course, Tony Blair, in his early days, had done everything he could to convince everybody that he wasn't who he actually was. That is to say that he was a very left-wing, almost a Corbynista. He was joining things like the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And it's almost as if he was creating a legend of somebody that he wasn't in order that people might vote for him and think that he was actually really left-wing when actually he wasn't.
I don't think there's much doubt that both Blair and Starmer are from that wing of the Labour Party, which is fawning on the establishment. And in many respects, neither of them particularly pretended to be anything else. Maybe Blair to some extent, and maybe Keir Starmer to some extent. But I think they always saw it in terms of, we've got to do this to get into power, we've got to, in order to, we've got to ingratiate ourselves with Labour activists, that's one of the jobs you've got to do in order to neutralise them, and then when we get to power, we are going to be loyal servants of big capital. And in many respects, they, you know, what you see is what you get with both of them.
Well, if you go back to 2005, it isn't really, because I've dug out a clip of, this is from the documentary which we at Culture Shop used to distribute before we had our bank accounts closed down. This is an online video documentary. We used to post them out as VHS, as DVDs, and this sort of thing. But then we were basically just shut down by the bank. It was the Co-op Bank in that time, just shut the bank account. So obviously people couldn't actually pay us for them anymore. In fact, when we first started, I suppose it would be about 2003, we had a wave of attacks on with using false credit cards and things like that and false names, so that we were getting a whole load of information which was completely bogus and no actual money to send the DVDs out to. So this was a cyber attack which the police dealt with quite well, actually. So let's have a listen now to this extract from this Mac Libel documentary, because I didn't realise that the trials, the various trials that took place between 1995, which was the main UK trial, and 96, right the way through to taking the whole thing to the European Court around 2005, these two individuals, Helen Steele and Dave Morris, had been sued by McDonald's for distributing leaflets which were making claims about how unhealthy the McDonald's food was, and also how it was badly affecting Indigenous people in other parts of the world. That sort of thing. They were terrific leaflets, but McDonald's stupidly decided to sue this unemployed couple from London. And eventually they won on some of the cases in the British courts, but in the European court they completely lost. But one of the reasons that they won anything at all was because a certain chap who was a barrister, completely free of charge, volunteered his time and effort to help them with their case, somebody called Keir Starmer. So let's have a listen now to Starmer in this Matt Leibel documentary, so you can get an idea of what he was up to between 1995 and 2005. Building his sort of legend about, I'm a really, really cool guy, I'm really left-wing, and I'll help anybody free of charge who's poor and doesn't have enough money for to be a barrister. Yeah, the other thing he says, have a listen for this as well, in this clip, is that without the legal aid system, there can be no justice. So it'd be interesting to see if he's forgotten all that now, he's become powerful.
The cross-examination was devastating so far as McDonald's were concerned, and many top lawyers would have been very proud to have got the answers that Dave and Helen managed to get out of McDonald's experts. And as a result, Mr. Rampton had to move the goalposts of his case. Instead of saying the particular phrase meant one thing, he now argues that it means something completely different.
We always knew it would be an uphill struggle to get evidence of direct involvement by McDonald's in tropical forest destruction. After all the witnesses and the official documents and so on were on the other side of the world, and we didn't have the resources to track them down and bring them to court.
You sit back and think about some of the witnesses that could have come on behalf of Dave and Helen, but didn't, because nobody could pay their airfare. The verdict pales into insignificance. It's meaningless. If both sides had had all the witnesses they wanted there, then a true verdict might have been possible. But with the best will in the world, the judge can only give a verdict according to the evidence. And the evidence costs money.
They had the libel team, the expert team of lawyers, working for the last 5 years behind the scenes and in court for them. That's where the victory lies, in the fact that Dave and Helen won almost half of this case with those odds stacked against them.
Some of the issues that Dave and Helen were raising, such as junk food and advertising to children, were not widely debated 10, 15, 20 years ago, but now they are mainstream. The case appears to have altered McDonald's tactics. Since the case, I don't think McDonald's has even threatened anybody with libel proceedings in similar circumstances.
5th of September 2004. Train to Strasbourg with Dave for the European hearing. We've beaten McDonald's, now it's the UK government's turn.
Dave and Helen are now taking their case to the European Court of Human Rights, which is the most important court in the whole of Europe, and will seek to argue that UK law is in breach of the European Convention of Human Rights, so the stakes could not be higher.
So there's a little extract, and I put the full clip of Keir Starmer, a young Keir Starmer, age about 35, 40, as this free barrister, this kind of gift horse to Dave Morris and Helen Steele in the libel case, which many older people will remember. I mean, it was a massive news for on and off for probably something like a decade as it went through its various stages, Martin. But, you know, the what I'm suggesting here is that maybe Starmer didn't really care that much about them. He was wanting to, sort of get a legend going about what a nice guy he was and how he really cared about ordinary, poor, unemployed people that couldn't afford justice, in order to, sort of help him in his future political career.
Well, you might say that, and it's possible that that he was making such calculations at that stage. Since you prodded me on this, one of the interesting things about that case is that the leaflet written by London Greenpeace was actually written, as I remember, by somebody who was actually an undercover police officer, had written the leaflet. And that's how a hall of mirrors the world we live in is. The idea that Keir Starmer at that stage was thinking, I'm going to leave the Labour Party and I need a legend, I think is unlikely. I think he wanted to be, you know, he wanted to be a Labour MP possibly, and therefore doing things like that would be drawing him in the right, you know, he could then point to this as, look, this is the sort of guy I am, and so on and so forth. You could say that anybody who does anything like that has got an ulterior motive, and maybe there is an ulterior motive, but you've just got to take, you know, on the other hand, you might just say, okay, well, that's what he was doing.
I mean, in hindsight, but with Blair, I mean, it was clearly obvious that his real politics had nothing to do with things like CND, wasn't it? I mean, I actually think things can be orchestrated and arranged for much longer periods of time. I think than you do organise it. I mean, the real worry, and of course, the guy I was trying to remember his name, Jonathan Holborough, who was the editor of the Mail on Sunday, that got a phone call from Tony Blair to say, what does Shayla know about his MI5 past? Because obviously he was concerned, and this is what Annie told us, that he was concerned, Blair was, that Shayla and Machon had seen Tony Blair's MI5 file and realised that he was actually working with, very closely with, the security services in years preceding becoming Prime Minister. And I wonder whether actually MI5 is taking a far, far greater role in our politics than we realise.
Well, I think it undoubtedly is. I don't think there's any doubt about that in my mind, certainly. It's quite possible that both Starmer and Blair are agents of influence of the British security services. Both of them actually say that they like to give the image that we are knowledgeable insiders in that world. Don't forget, Starmer was director of public prosecutions. He likes to boast how many terrorists he sent to prison and all the rest of it. It's part of his CV that he's proud of. And Blair as well. Blair, I remember at one stage saying that he was the most left-wing member of his sixth form. And of course, he went to Fettes College, which is the Scottish version of Eton. And no doubt he was the most left-wing member of his sixth form, but that doesn't mean he's left wing. And of course, the right wing of the Labour Party is pretty right wing. It's always been pretty right wing.
It's fair to say that this just doesn't just apply to the Labour Party by any means. You look at somebody like Sunak and his attachment to Goldman Sachs. I mean, this is another very powerful network which is working against the public interest, and it's got its own special interests, which much of our politics now is following these special interests. And it seems to me that very few of our MPs, particularly those who are in the shadow cabinet or in the government itself, or even in the leading positions in any of the opposition parties, have got any real interest in what voters have to say, because they realise which side their bread's buttered.
Well, also, that to be fair, Tony, they say that they do take an interest in what voters have to say in the swing marginal constituencies where people read the Daily Mail and decide whether they're going to vote Labour or Tory. So they would say that they do listen. Of course, you've missed one name out of all of this, Jeremy Corbyn, who's been kicked out of the Labour Party, even though he's been a member of it since he was a teenager. So there are politicians who are not part of the cabal, and we all know what happens to them. And of course, therefore, you could draw the conclusion that there's no point going down that road if you want to achieve anything. You've got to compromise with these people. You've got to get in with MI5 and make sure you've neutralised them. I mean, Corbyn himself went to talk to MI5. He gave a report back on it after he was removed from the leadership, saying, you know, he went to talk to them and tried to talk sense into them. They were pretty hostile. And there you are. And we all know that's what goes on. Now, the majority of people in this country, many of them don't care about MI5. You and I care about it. Most of them don't. They should, but they don't. And therefore, listening to ordinary people means listening to their non-knowledge of things like that, because they don't know anything about it, and they don't want to know anything about it, many of them.
I'm reminded of, is it a Gladstone quote or something like that, that where he says that the country's run by very different personages than people who are not themselves behind the scenes can
thing running the country. That's a very bolderized version of the quote, but that's along those lines. I mean, we've seen the security. I mean, the security services, as we know, are very much involved. We had a good discussion about this last week about election fixing when it came to Corbyn. You know, all these people, which were well known to MI5 through the anti-terror hotline, conducting very convenient terrorist attacks just before the 2017 general election. And then, like, literally a week before the general election took place, we had the smears all across the newspapers, the national press, about Jeremy Corbyn being a terrorist. I mean, it does seem to me as if they're rather taking the mickey when it comes to making sure that the people get, or anybody that's half decent that gets anywhere close to power in Britain is smeared by the press to make sure they will never get power. And of course, this isn't democracy at all.
Well, it isn't. You could say it's not. It's an oligarchy with a facade of democracy, and that's always been the case. It's never been different. We need a democracy, but that will require a bit of a revolution, Tony.
Yeah, you see, I don't agree. I think it's after World War II, for a while, things did get better. I think there was a lot more freedom of who could and couldn't be an MP, what they could and couldn't say without getting cancelled, etc. I mean, you know, we did have a very decent prime minister, for example, in Harold Wilson, and then there was the Wilson plot in the 1970s. I think it was 1976, wasn't it? He was forced to resign by the security services. So it does seem as if ever since then they've been really running the show.
Well, they were running the show before Wilson came to power, when Stafford Cripps was running the show in 1945, and Ernie Bevin was his foreign secretary. They were very much, pro-NATO, pro-American. They wanted nuclear weapons. They wanted to keep the empire. So although the social reforms that were carried through their relationship with the powerful was still pretty subservient. And this is still the case. To try and change society properly is actually an uphill struggle. And no, it's always going to be so.
Well, I remember, Simon Fairley's quote from last week, as he's saying, it's always a bit of a rearguard action. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's always a rearguard action. We're able to gain small victories, but the big stuff eludes us because the powerful are powerful, and that's they have all the power. That's the definition. The ruling class rules. That's what they do.
That Annie chatting to us about Jonathan Holborough at the Mail on Sunday and Blair. Blair took him I think it was on a Monday after they'd published on Sunday the leaks from these MI5 whistleblowers, and Blair took him out took him out into the garden because he thought that it was less chance of it being bugged out there. Is that true?
Well, I don't. This is a story I wasn't there, Tony, so I don't know whether it was true or not. But it certainly sounds believable, yeah.
Martin, you missed the point of my question. Do you think it is actually safer if you're out in the garden or outside rather than inside to be able to speak without being bugged?
Well, it can be. When we went to Sark all those years ago, I was speaking to the guy who was the elected head of Sark, and he said, we're going to go and speak in the garden because he said, my house is bugged by the Barclay brothers. There's all sorts of different ways of avoiding being bugged. You can go for a long walk in the woods where you don't know where you're going. If you don't know where you're going, they don't know where you're going. And there's all sorts of other techniques, which, of course, if you are involved in spycraft as a professional, like an IRA volunteer, for example, you get taught all this stuff. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it works. And, of course, there's plenty of ways to get information because if you know people, you can get information indirectly and so on. This is all a huge realm in which, you know, there's all sorts of fictional books about it, Tony, as you know, based on reality, but fiction.
Very, very good factual stuff as well, particularly about MI5's interference at the BBC, making sure that certain journalists are sacked or not allowed to get jobs in the first place. There's something called the Christmas Tree Files, where MI5 went through all the files of all the BBC journalists. And any of the ones who may have left-wing sympathies got a little Christmas tree rubber stamp kind of stuck onto their Well, it was just on the file, on the outside of the file, and it was a code. The idea is this little Christmas tree sign meant this is a left winger. Make sure we get rid of them, basically. And this had been going on ever since the 1960s and 70s, and it was outed, I think, in the 1980s. So they have a lot of power, the security services. One of the latest articles, which is just from last week, I think this is the Tory party acted swiftly to block would-be MPs after warnings from MI5. The party removed two people from the candidates list after warning in 2021 that they could be Chinese spies. The Conservative Party acted swiftly to block potential parliamentary candidates after warnings from MI5 they could be spying for China. The Health Minister, Maria Caulfield, was speaking after it was revealed Tories dropped two potential candidates after MI5 warnings. Now, I mean, we know from this sort of interference that it may be that these people weren't, but they wouldn't have been told. The idea is that the MI5 seemed to have quite an interesting, you know, an interesting role here. If this was to be done fairly, then, of course, these specific individuals would be given an opportunity to explain, you know, what are your connections with China? Are you a spy or something? But no, they are just literally crossed off the list. And that may not be a bad or good. How, I mean, people don't necessarily realise that this kind of vetting is going on.
They don't, but many of them presume it's going on, and they presume it's all for the best, because they tend to trust the authorities. When they say that the Chinese are spying on us, they think, oh gosh, that's terrible, we've got to stop this stuff. And that's because they're propagandized about, you know, China and what it represents and all the rest of it. People like us who are concerned about these kind of things and the threat to democracy that they represent, we don't necessarily speak for the majority who tend to go along with what they're told, because that's what people do unless they've got a reason not to. And, you know, it's a struggle to break through to those people and get them to understand why it's important that all this stuff is exposed and people need to think about it. But there's plenty of people who don't want to think about it.
Well, I know, but we do, and I'm sure our listeners do. I mean, the other thing, of course, is that there may be Israeli spies, but we don't really hear much about that, do we?
No, we don't, because they basically get allowed to do whatever they like. So we're here trying to prevent the Chinese, basically, probably mostly what the Chinese are interested in is industrial espionage. That's the most likely thing that they're being engaged in. The Israelis are here to steer our foreign policy in a warlike direction. And, of course, they get away with it. There's a former Mossad guy who's working as head of communications for the Labour Party as we speak. I've forgotten his name, but he used to work, in the tech wing of Mossad, and he's been recruited by the Labour Party to be their communications chief. I think that says it all, doesn't it?
Isn't it interesting how there's no MI5 vetting for him, and yet there is this week UK authorities charge five Bulgarian nationals accused of spying in the UK. British prosecutors have authorised charges to be brought against these five Bulgarian nationals. So, I mean, I thought Bulgaria was an ally, but no, apparently the Bulgarians are spying on us, if you believe MI5.
Well, I mean, what strikes me about MI5 is they used to be rather mysterious kind of organisation, the same with MI6. But now, they're in the social media age, their leadership are on the TV all the time telling us what's going on. And you know, they've become more prominent in many ways, have become more powerful since 9/11 in particular than they were before. And of course, because the population have been terrorised, they believe that the security services are there to protect them. Whereas, of course, it may very well be that they are in fact part of the problem and not part of the solution. And ultimately, they may have to be disbanded and reformed, as the KGB was in Russia. The KGB was disbanded, and a wholly new organisation, the FSB, was set up. And that's what happens when you have revolutions.
Yeah, apparently they're supposed to be spying for the Russians, even though they are Bulgarians. So what's all that about? Of course, you know, this is all allegations. Let's just stress that it's all allegations. There may be nothing to it. But of course, even if there isn't, the Crown Prosecution Service have said that there is enough evidence to take them to trial. And of course, we see nothing like this, as I say. So, for example, for people from the United States who might be spying in the US interests, or people from Israel.
Well, that's right. I mean, a lot of this stuff is either it's not true, and basically it's all made up. It's a kind of moulding the mind of the population. You know, if you find a few spies once in a while, that keeps everybody, oh, yes, there are spies. We've got to look out for them. I saw some in the bushes earlier. And also, of course, it's the obvious is the sort of double standards involved. The Israelis have massively penetrated our politics and everything, every level. And they are very active, and they steer our policy in certain directions. They were very much in favour of war with Iraq, for example. Okay, so that they were very keen on all of that. And of course, you and I know very well that we suspect the Israelis of involvement in terrorist activities in this country. Just one small minor incident compared to some of the big ones is a couple of Palestinians were charged with bombing the Israeli embassy, and then they're sent to prison. They're still in prison, but of course it was actually an Israeli false flag, which then led to the invasion of Lebanon in 1982. I've spoken to Palestinians who say that these guys are innocent. And of course, this goes on, and it isn't chased up by the security services, because the security services work with the Israelis. They're not there to protect us from them. They're part of the same allied structure. Ultimately, of course, what may have to happen, as happened in Russia in the 1990s, is you get rid of the whole lot. You just disband the whole existing security forces, and you rehire people that are reliable to the new setup. And that's probably what we're going to have to do in the end. That's what you do have to do.
Okay, so let's also have a look at the decision of Rupert Murdoch to step down. I mean, this is obviously one of the major targets for the security services is the press, to try and make sure they get their word out through the press that their London media controls the narrative. I mean, it's a very bizarre, I think, the way that all the national and international coverage of news in the entire pretty much UK. Okay, so there's some separate stuff just about in Belfast and a little bit in Scotland as well. But, certainly most of the UK, everything comes from London. And it's obviously much easier to control when that happens. But let's have a listen now to Rupert Murdoch's announcement today that Lachlan is going to be taking over, his son. I think it was James Murdoch he was touted as taking over the British operation a while ago, but now apparently no, it's Lachlan, as Rupert Murdoch's going to step down as the chairman. Although I was hearing some reports saying he was chief executive, which he obviously is not chief executive of News Corp or Fox or anything. He's chairman. So anyway, let's have a listen now to that report on Rupert Murdoch.
US media mogul Rupert Murdoch has announced he'll step down as chairman of Fox and News Corporation. The 92-year-old created Fox Broadcasting in 1986. It eventually became the number one cable news channel in the US, known for carrying Republican talking points. His son Lachlan Murdoch will become the sole chairman of both companies. Let's go to Heidi Jo Castro for more on this. So how is this news being received there, Heidi?
Well, it is a pretty earth-shattering thing in the media landscape here in the United States, but certainly one that has been expected given the age of Rupert Murdoch, who is now 92. But he has long been such an active presence guiding his two companies, Fox Corporation and News Corp, and really actively involved in the editorial guidance, particularly at Fox News, which, of course, is the leading conservative voice among the media in the United States. So given his age, this is not altogether unexpected. However, he did write in this memo to employees this morning that he is staying on as the chair emeritus of both of these companies, which is also unsurprising. Now, who is going to take on the role of the chief executive? Well, Rupert Murdoch has two sons, and the one that he is giving these companies to is also the one that people have long expected. And that is Lachlan Murdoch, who has already been basically running these companies with his father's guidance over the last few years.
Yeah, so that's an Al Jazeera report. Martin, you know, Murdoch's been a very interesting figure. I mean, for me, a complete... I mean, I know you were there, down there in Wapping all those years ago, trying to stop the smashing of the print unions, particularly by the Rupert Murdoch papers down in Docklands, and this is mainly the Times, etc. But, I think recently, you know, he's kind of turned a corner a little bit in that most of the media is controlled, but his empire has been actually doing some of the better reporting, particularly Sky News Australia on COVID, and Fox News, really the only Western channels, mainstream media channels, that have been exposing this, the links between the Pentagon and the Wuhan lab, which almost certainly, as we now know, developed the, and in fact the Russians have said this too now as well, absolutely, it developed this bioweapon called COVID-19. So without Murdoch, I wonder whether that story would have made it out there really to a massive audience, because it's obviously a lot of attempts to kind of keep the lid on this kind of thing, which Rupert Murdoch has just said, well, basically, up yours, I'm going to publish this and be damned, basically.
Well, let's think about this. The reason why the Western establishment was saying we don't want to go down the road of saying this is a lab leak is because the people who were deep in the establishment knew that it was indeed a laboratory created virus and that it had been deliberately leaked. So it wasn't an accidental leak. Now, of course, Rupert Murdoch and his newspapers and his news shows haven't gone down that road, and they haven't gone down the road of saying, well, 9/11 was carried out by our own security forces. We're talking, so in other words, it's limited hangout, isn't it? And of course, Tucker Carlson, who exposed the fact that DARPA were funding the Wuhan lab, has been removed by Murdoch. And he's obviously making a career for himself outside of the Murdoch empire. I don't want to rely on people like Rupert Murdoch to get my news. Even if he does some good things sometimes, the whole policy of having people like him in control of the media, and if it wasn't him, it'd be somebody else, is not on. We need to actually have genuinely free media, which is actually independent of billionaire control.
The thing is, of course, there is some around. In fact, quite a lot of countries have got much freer and independent media. It's just that more of them are being censored and blocked in the West.
Well, that's right. The idea that Rupert Murdoch is some kind of hero, I'm simply not going to buy. He has been a pernicious influence for many, many years.
I'm not saying the guy's a hero. I think most journalists, certainly journalists that I know, rather poo-poo the idea that, oh, the Daily Mail's rubbish, I never read it. What we do is we look at a bit of everything, and you'll find that almost every outlet has something, usually 90% rubbish, but the 5 or 10% of stuff that they do is brilliant. And if you could have a media outlet where it was just like the cream of the crop from all of the best, then people would be much, much better enlightened on what's going on in the world. But the press has just become another thing for BlackRock and Vanguard and these massive private equity firms to take over when they start, and whether individual journalists or proprietors start to go off message, they then just get bullied, targeted and shut down.
Well, that's right. I mean, we're living in a soup of fabricated information. So, for example, just one small example, a few weeks ago, it was claimed that the Russians had fired a missile at a market in East Ukraine and killed 15 people, including children. And Zelensky immediately denounced it as Russian barbarism. And all the media over here, politicians, the Murdoch press, all joined in and said, yes, this is more example of Russian barbarism. Although it's come out this week as Zelensky arrives in New York, the New York Times reported that in actual fact the missile was fired from the Ukrainian side. And it was a Ukrainian missile that killed those people. Now, most people will have only heard the first part of the story. Oh, yes, another Russian missile killing civilians. And then the second bit of the story is sotto voce. Oh, yes, but in actual fact, it was a Ukrainian missile. And, of course, the real question is whether it was deliberate or accidental. because it could well have been a deliberate attack like the one at Kramatorsk over a year ago now, which killed loads of people, claimed to be a Russian missile, turned out to be a Ukrainian missile, deliberately killing civilians to blame the Russians. And that's not because the Ukrainians are particularly vicious and criminal and devious. They were advised to do that by the intelligence services of Britain, the people talking about earlier.
Okay, well, let's look at the Bucha massacre then, because that looks as if it had been very, very similar. The idea is that the NATO intelligence services have said, well, actually, if you go and murder a load of Ukrainians, if so long, you know, please, if you don't mind, we reckon we can spin it as a Russian attack. And so, therefore, you know, this a lot of what we're seeing, I think, is relying on a supine mass media right across the Western world.
It is, and it's not just that they distort factual things about things that have happened. They actually go out and create the incidents which are then used to beat the enemy with. So the 9/11 attack wasn't carried out by people living in caves in Afghanistan. But nevertheless, the people in Afghanistan have paid a terrible price for what was done, and even though they had nothing to do with it.
We're going to come to 9/11 in a little while, but I wonder if you could just say something about Bucha, because it's something that many people remember. The way the word Bucha is designed to be rememberable, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, they may have chosen that because Bucha sounds like butcher in English. It's as cynical as that. What happened was the Russians withdrew from their thrust on Kiev because they'd agreed with Zelensky that there was going to be a negotiation. They were negotiating in Istanbul under the auspices of the Turks and the Israelis, that a deal would be done and they would, you know, the Minsk agreements would be fulfilled, and they withdrew their forces. What had happened was, as when their forces went in, they were handing out, you know, things like tampons and bottled water and so on to people, you know, where they were. Anybody who took anything off the Russian forces was regarded by the Ukrainian nationalists as a traitor. So once the Russian army had withdrawn from Bucha, the mayor of Bucha, the previous mayor who'd been in hiding, came out and he went on the media and said, thank goodness the Russians have gone. We've won a great victory here, isn't it wonderful? We're very happy. 3 days later, loads of bodies were found lying all over the streets with their hands tied behind their backs. Don't forget, the Russian army had been gone for at least 48 hours when that happened. And the first thing he said was that we're all fine and we're glad that they're all gone. And then, of course, they were all wearing white armbands. And these were apparently what the Russians were handing out, white armbands for people that they knew were on their side. So, in other words, I don't know whether they actually wore those armbands. These people were picked out by the SBU and the Azov battalion as traitors to the Ukrainian cause. And in actual fact, they've been doing a lot of that in the Ukraine. It's a civil war. Many people on the Ukrainian side of the line are, in fact, sympathetic to the Russians. The Ukrainian military and security services know that. And they kill these people. And then they say, oh, look, the Russians have killed these people. Because it's part of the strategy. It's a Psy war strategy. The shootings in the Maidan Square in 2014, we know, because there was a court case in Kiev, were carried out by snipers from Georgia and two from Lithuania, orchestrated by an American called Boyenga. In other words, that was a NATO hit. And they killed those people and then said, isn't it terrible? The regime has just shot a load of demonstrators. They do this all the time. The NATO intelligence services for many years have been involved in terrorism, which is then blamed on somebody else, and then they say what you need is more security services. You need more us to stop this kind of thing, even though they are, in fact, the perpetrators. Ultimately, what we need is serious police officers and the will to put these people behind bars.
Yeah, well, I wonder whether how those police officers would get on when they're being spied on themselves. I mean, we're now in a situation where there isn't any real proper regulation of surveillance at all. Surveillance is becoming ubiquitous right across in, so there's no need to go to get a court order from a judge to put someone under surveillance. The police will be under surveillance if they happen to be investigating someone who's a friend of MI5 or the deep state. The MPs will be under surveillance. Journalists will be under surveillance. It's just becoming totally ubiquitous. And this week, it's been revealed that the Home Office has been actually lobbying for a facial recognition spy company. Officials reflected policing ministers' enthusiasm to roll out a controversial technology across the country, particularly in retail settings. Now, these are the sort of things that where you go and buy something in a supermarket, you'll see some kind of weird camera device, a picture of your own face, where you're being your face is being recorded, and it might be that your face is being transmitted using facial recognition software. Thankfully, Silky Carlo, bless her, and Big Brother Watch are doing their best to keep track of this. So if you're not already on their mailing list and supporting Big Brother Watch, please do. The story is that senior officials at the Home Office secretly lobbied the UK's independent privacy regulator to act favourably towards a private firm keen to roll out controversial facial recognition technology across the country. Correspondence reveals the Home Office wrote to the Information Commissioner's Office warning that the policing minister, Chris Philip, would write to your commissioner if the regulator's investigation into FaceWatch, whose facial recognition cameras have provoked huge opposition after being installed in shops, was not positive towards the firm. So there you go. This is the government who's supposed to be acting for us, Martin, just increasing this mass pervasive surveillance with no scrutiny by the courts whatsoever.
Well, that's right. And, of course, in the US, it's actually in the Constitution that without a judge's order or a national security concern, it is illegal for the state to spy on the citizens. But, of course, it's just ignored. And the only, really, what ultimately you could say can happen is that those who are opposed to the state start spying on the state. So, in other words, using the same sort of techniques and technologies, you identify people who are involved. And, of course, back in the day, the Provisional IRA would go round to their house and kill them, because that's the answer to that, isn't it?
And at the same time, we've got Britain quietly passing something called the Online Safety Bill into law this week. Some note is the information, says Off Guardian this week, is the Information Offences Clause. Well, this does sound, I mean, it's just George Orwell, isn't it? He could have been writing this, which empowers Ofcom to demand information from users, companies and employees, and makes it a crime to withhold it. The nature of this information is not specified, nor does it appear to be in any way qualified, meaning it could be anything. Well, most likely to be used to get private account information about users from social media platforms, including their passwords. In one of the more worrying clauses, the bill outlines what they call communications offences. Section 10 deals with crimes of transmitting harmful, false and threatening communications. It should be noted that sending threats is already illegal in the UK, so one wonders why exactly the internet giants are being threatened with this new law. So effectively what they're saying is, we're not going to actually police the internet, but we are going to encourage all these big internet companies to do that for us. And if at any point we find that they've done something wrong, we're going to hit them with a massive fine. Now, this is not really a law, is it? It's just saying to the big the Facebooks, the Googles, the rest of them, that unless you do what we want and enforce all these things and make sure that all the communications are just the way we want them, then we're gonna issue these multi-million pound fines. So there's a lot of commentators around the world looking at what's happening in Britain, because there are similar bits of legislation going through the place as usual in this crazy world of ours, which is supposed to be independent parliaments, but it seems to be just one great empire deciding these things. Martin, it could be the end of the internet, some are saying.
Well, as you know, our colleague Kevin Cahill has been pursuing through the courts this whole issue of the tech giants spying on behalf of the NSA and the other, three alphabet soup of agencies that spy on us all. Because, as I said earlier, it's actually unconstitutional in the US to spy on people without a reason, although it's just totally ignored.
Kevin has pointed out that they're also spying on children, which is totally unlawful and against the European human rights legislation, and yet they're doing it anyway.
Well, that's because it's very difficult to stop a powerful state with all of the, you know, resources that they have from doing what they want. Although it is the case that it's illegal. And of course, what Kevin's been suggesting is this is a civil offence. This is the misuse of people's data. And therefore, you can't sue the intelligence services, but you can sue the multinationals who work for them. And if everybody, you know, sued them for a few thousand pounds each, that could bankrupt them. Which, of course, is what he's trying to do. But, well, of course, it's an uphill struggle because all of the tools are in the hands of the powerful, aren't they?
It's amazing. The same week, at the same time, the US Supreme Court has overturned a ruling previously won by free speech advocates. The Biden administration has now been given the green light to push social media giants to remove any so-called false or misleading content. So what we're seeing, I think, you know, be honest with you, I mean, you and I were both around in the late 60s and 1970s where there was all sorts of great stuff on television and radio. You know, it was pretty much any filmmaker could pretty much get their stuff onto TV in those days. You could sort of walk in, chat to the TV people. Yeah, they'll show it. And especially if it pulled in an audience for adverts. But now, of course, the whole system of television and radio, the official system anyway, not this show, is being used just to hypnotize people effectively with specific narratives. And that's what its purpose is. And it seems that we may be on the cusp of the same sort of thing happening in the world of the Internet, where that is all being shut down in a similar way. So perfect, I think, anyway, to now look at the situation with Russell Brand this week. Fascinating to see this documentary. I first came across this when Russell himself put out which was shared on various social media platforms, a video saying, look, they're about to do a smear campaign on me, just to say that this is, I've been expecting this for a while. And I'm no fan of Russell Brand, but I think we should start by just listening to the sort of thing he says, which might have upset some rich and powerful people, and particularly anyone who was trying to control the narrative. So let's have a listen to Brand now talking about what effectively, he doesn't use the word accelerationist at all here, but he's talking about exactly what I have been talking about and many others have been talking about, which is this multiple crisis creation policy and ways to make money out of it. And of course, Naomi Klein talked about it, is the shock doctrine and the idea of disaster capitalism, a kind of dystopian world that we're being shoved into by these anarcho-capitalists. So let's have a listen now to a little, it's only about a minute and a half clip, or maybe 2 minutes clip from Russell Brand. And I have a listen and think why this might upset some people, since he's got a massive following, particularly amongst youngsters.
Out of respect for you and your show, I've brought some facts. Would you... if you like, they're actually...
You just get the fuck out of here. This is not the place.
We love facts.
I love facts.
I wouldn't have mentioned it. I'm English, and you know that politeness is our fundamental religion. But they do pertain to this issue, so may I say something?
Please,
if they inconvenience you, I'll stop saying them. The pandemic created at least 40 new big pharma billionaires. Pharmaceutical corporations like Moderna and Pfizer made $1,000 of profit every second from the COVID-19 vaccine. More than two-thirds of Congress received campaign funding from pharmaceutical companies in the 2020 election. Pfizer chairman Albert Bourla told Time magazine in July 2020 that his company was developing a COVID vaccine for the good of humanity, not for money. And of course, Pfizer made $100 billion in profit in 2022. Right. And may I just mention, finally, and this is also a fact, that you, the American public, funded the development of that. The German public funded the BioNTech vaccine. When it came to the profits, they took the profits. When it came to the funding, you paid for the funding. All I'm querying is this.
Yes.
Is if you have an economic system in which pharmaceutical companies benefit hugely from medical emergencies, where a military-industrial complex benefits from war, where energy companies benefit from energy crises, you are going to generate states of perpetual crisis where the interests of ordinary people separate from the interests of the elite.
Yeah, well, that's Russell Brand there. The sort of things he's been saying have been very much, I mean, his first thing that happened to him pretty much is he got demonetized on YouTube. And then there's this rather nasty letter sent by the chair of Culture, Media and Sport Committee to Rumble saying, well, we think it would be rather nice. Of course, this is in the background of all of this. We're thinking about this Disinformation Act, the so-called online safety, the online censorship bill. That the government's putting through. So this is a kind of threat in a way to Rumble, saying, listen, we're the regulators, we can destroy you, you know, by fining you, and why is it that you're not doing exactly what we want when it comes to Russell Brand and his channel? And the fact of the matter is that the people that run Rumble, whoever they are, have decided they quite like Russell Brand and that they are prepared to stand up to the government and possibly even in court. So, Martin, what do you make of this this last, I think it was Saturday night, wasn't it? Or maybe Sunday evening. Saturday evening, I think it was. Hour and a half documentary about alleged sexual assaults by Russell Brand.
Well, I think that sexual assaults should be taken seriously, but I think it's very bizarre that none of these women have been to the police, because if there was a serious case to be made, that's where you go, surely. So, people are innocent till proven guilty. I can well believe that somebody like Russell Brand has probably done some things in his past which others might find distasteful or unpleasant. But if they're not criminal offences, they're not criminal offences. And if they are criminal offences, you don't try those by media. The police need to look into it. If women have got allegations against them, they need to go to the police, and the police need to look into it. That's what strikes me as very odd about all of this. If these are genuine allegations, they are criminal allegations, they need to be criminally investigated. Just putting around stories about this and that and the other, and if you haven't been to the police with it, well, you're not serious about it, are you?
Well, I thought about a chap called Simon Killane, who's been on our show before, and the campaign to destroy him. Which, when I saw this stuff with Russell Brand, I mean, I'm genuinely very rarely watch Russell Brand. I just find him quite unpleasant to watch. But that doesn't mean to say that I don't recognise the attempt here to a character assassinate the guy. Basically, it's what we call in the business a hatchet job. The other thing is, of course, he's been set up over the years as an individual who's quite popular. And one of the things that the press seems to love to do these days, particularly, is to set people up as celebrities just to smash them and knock them down. This has a very interesting effect, I think, on the public, which is to destroy morale. So somebody that you thought was great is then proved to be no good, as obviously as Jimmy Savile was. So it's almost as if this is an attempt to almost Jimmy Savile Russell. The only thing is, of course, there is actually no real evidence at the moment that that he's guilty of anything so far. Very much like, I think, very much like Prince Andrew. Andrew has allegedly had sex with a 17-year-old inverted commas prostitute, because she is also a victim, of course. And I'm not saying he's not a victim. I think she was a victim in this Mossad sting too. But there are definitely attempts to use these sexual assault allegations in order to try and destroy people. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Simon Killane, who explains how the campaign to destroy him went a couple of years ago. He was actually very influential councillor in Wiltshire who was completely changing the way that the planning system worked in the county.
What I want to do is explain to you what is actually happening. You don't have to believe or not believe Russell Brand. You don't even have to care about Russell Brand. So what happened to me was an orchestrated campaign to destroy my reputation, because as an independent elected representative, I upset a small group of people who had a lot of power and a lot of control and were making decisions about major financial decisions in the local area. So I ended up basically, I often say, accidentally coming across a drug dealer's stash. And then because of that, a whole kind of mechanistic process of character assassination was created. And very simply, examples of, I was accused of sexual assaulting somebody. I was accused of attacking a woman in the street. I was accused of attacking a small child. I was accused of driving my car inappropriately and nearly killing a woman's child in her buggy. I was accused of driving my car down the wrong end of High Street. There were multiple hate campaigns, calling me out as an Irish traveller, gypsy, threats of violence, threats of murder, all sorts of things. And it was totally orchestrated.
Simon, I think I remember there was also even graffiti in your local town.
Yeah, graffiti. And this is where there's a mechanistic process going on here, and I can see it with Russell Brand. If Russell Brand did or didn't do these things, the first thing you think is, if I was a victim, why would I go to a newspaper and tell them a whole pile of intimate details about something, things somebody had done to me many years ago? The first thing you do would be go to the police. Right? The second thing is that the people who are making these reports, if found out, for them, the whole process of explaining the horrible sexual assaults and so on, for them is also a really difficult thing. They need to have some sort of privacy. His wife, his children, like he has one or two children, the kind of scrutiny, the kind of pressure on them, forget about him, but on them is going to be immense. And the way these things are done is to basically destroy his character, destroy his reputation, make the public believe from the way they create the narrative that he's guilty before any kind of proper judicial process. But also to probably turn his wife against him, to make the life of his wife and her children almost impossible. So that what will happen is he will withdraw from public life. He will just withdraw and say, and this is exactly what happened to me. In the end, I had to leave. I had to come out of public life because it became such a burden on me and my family, my children. My wife had a terrible time. I would say nearly had a nervous breakdown over it. I was pretty strong. I was able to go, I know what's going on here. But for me, in the end, it was unsustainable. I had to leave public life because of it.
So that's Simon Killane, former councillor from Wiltshire. I mean, he certainly wasn't a celebrity, except as he explains that people did used to greet him in the local town in Malmesbury where he was based. Although he was a Wiltshire county councillor, he'd managed to make some big differences in the way the planning decisions were being made in and around Wiltshire, and he upset some people. So there was a campaign to destroy him. I just think it's been, you know, it's fascinating to compare these two cases, and also particularly Simon. And there's a longer interview. It's about 30 minutes, 40 minutes long with Simon about the Russell Brand incident, where he makes lots of comparisons between what happened to him and what he sees being done to Russell Brand, which I'll put up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. Let's have a listen now to Simon's take on whether it's going to be possible for the deep state, for the London media, for the vested interests, the cartels, etc., to put the Russell Brand genie back into the bottles. Is it going to be possible to actually character assassinate him when he's got so many young followers? And maybe this whole idea of character assassination by TV isn't working as well as it used to work. So let's have a listen to our second clip with Simon Killane now.
It's a bit like when the printing press was first invented. I don't think you can put the genie back in the bottle unless you shut the internet down. You're not going to be able to control. They're trying to control it. They're trying to infiltrate it. You heard about the Twitter files and all, but they can't. And I totally agree. I think that it's going to, people really need to wake up and realize that they're being duped. That's you want to know the truth. You know, Tucker Carlson has made a suggestion. I'm not a fan of Tucker Carlson, but he's gone off and he's doing his own independent thing. Tucker Carlson, I don't know how many views he gets, but it's more than any of the legacy media. Tucker Carlson has suggested he might interview Putin. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine what potentially would happen to Tucker Carlson? Because nobody wants to actually allow us, the public, to hear everyone's side of the story, that us as intelligent people come along and decide what we want and decide what we think. They're trying to basically program everything. Just because somebody interviews somebody else doesn't mean that they're taking one side or the other. I would like to hear from an American, somebody who's independent, what the views of these people are, whether it's Trump or it's Putin or it's Biden. Have them all in a room and clarify what the situation. I would like to see RFK challenged about his claims about the CIA and what happened to his parents and his relatives. I would like to see that happen. But there's a whole set of there's a whole grouping of people who do not want that to happen in the US. What they don't want to happen is for ordinary people to be able to hear the truth. And it's exactly what happened. You've probably heard of a guy called William Tyndale. William Tyndale was the first guy to convert the Bible from Latin to English. What happened to him? He was burnt at the stake, and they made a compromise. They said, we'll strangle you first. And that's what they did. And his Bible became the King James Bible, and it's the Bible today that people have access to. Why? Because they said, we don't want the public being able to read the Bible because they don't know enough. They're not able to basically understand it. It's only experts who can speak Latin that should be allowed to read the Bible. And so you're seeing the same thing happen now. It's exactly the same thing. The internet and this kind of media is giving us all the opportunity to find out much more truthful, open, honest sort of understandings about what's going on. And those people who have controlled it for decades do not want to let go of it. But they have to let go. They have no choice. The more they fight, like you said, the more they're going to basically cause us as the public to sort of twig. There's something going on here. Why do you think I'm so animated here now? I sit here, listen and see this stuff, and I think, oh my gosh, do people understand what this these PR companies, these political forces, these vested are capable of doing? How would you feel if somebody looks you in the eye and said to you, your children could disappear or drown? You need to get out of this stuff. They don't threaten you with killing or murdering your children. They just basically give you a narrative to say, we know you've got family, you've got children, you've got a wife, you've got a job. In my job, I have my boss call me into his office, pull out a letter and say to me, I've got this letter. And in this letter, I've heard a whole pile of stuff being accusations being made about you. The letter was clearly sent to him so I would be sacked and I'd lose my job. I'd have no income. I had a mortgage. I had children to feed. What did my boss say? He tore it up, the letter, and put it in the bin. He said, Simon, you've worked here for 6 years. You're a decent guy. I don't believe a word of it. And I was lucky.
Well, yes, he was lucky in his job that his boss didn't take that seriously. I mean, it's quite obvious. And in the longer interview, Simon explains that these sorts of operations are conducted by strategic communications companies such as Sven Hughes worked for, and also public relations firms, Martin, as a sort of multifaceted takedown destruction of an individual. Now, I mean, I have no idea whether Russell Brand is guilty or not guilty, but really, in our journalistic training, we were all told, all journalists are told this, that these unsubstantiated claims are not news, that they really have to go through a test. So, I mean, I could make an accusation, St. Martin, against you on here, and unless it's actually been proved in court, it doesn't really mean anything. I can say it, and it's all it is just rumour and hearsay. So it certainly shouldn't be news, just an accusation, until it's been in some way tested, whether it's in a tribunal, in a court, or through some kind of proper process. Russell Brand is now apparently facing today another sexual misconduct allegation. Well, this is exactly how these PR companies work. It's because they'll have a whole load of allegations over weeks and weeks. It'll be a drip, drip, drip effect to come out. So I think, to me, until there is something actually proven in court, whether it's against Prince Andrew or, in this case, Russell Brand, then they should just shut up about it. And also, with all this new laws shutting down the internet coming along, this seems to be the right time to do something like this to Brand, who is such an internet star. And of course, in the background to all of this, Martin, is the ramping up of this war with Russia. And it could be that that's going to go to a whole nother level. And so maybe that the takedown of Brand may be even linked to an escalation in the war, because, of course, it's very important that the powers that be, the Anglo-Zionist Empire, has complete control of the media, both social media and the mass media, if things escalate in Ukraine.
Well, I think that's certainly so. In relation to Prince Andrew, of course, he settled out of court, but he paid millions of pounds to settle. which implied that he accepted that he didn't want to go to court because he'd be found guilty. So in that case, there was a court case, which he settled by paying the people off.
Well, no, it wasn't a court case. Let's just be clear.
It was a civil case, Tony.
Martin, it wasn't a civil case. It was a settlement out of court because there was a legal letter sent to him threatening a court case. I mean, if he's got lots and lots of money, he may just decide, well, I may lose the court case or I don't want the publicity associated with the court case and just pay him off to shut him down.
All right, but the point I'm making is that some procedure was ferried out there. There's been no procedure whatsoever in the case of Russell Brand, has been pointed out by your interviewee there.
Russell Brand and the royal family are poles apart in terms of the amount of cash that they've got to throw around.
Well, they are indeed, but I'm just saying that when you make the case that there's got to, you know, that if people are going to make allegations about stuff, there's got to be something behind it, not just people say so. In Prince Andrew's case, there was a court case which he settled out of court, which then implies that he didn't want to go to court.
No,
all right, so this is a minor point.
Martin, it's not a minor point because the evidence was not tested in court. It was settled out of court.
Yeah, but it's settled out of court because if he went to court, he'd be found guilty. That's the implication.
Absolute nonsense. He wouldn't necessarily be found guilty if he'd gone to court. It may be that he's just decided, because he's got all this money swilling around, that he's going to settle out of court just to avoid all the time and effort and the bad publicity that might come from a court
case.
Well,
as I said to the other week, there's allegations coming out from Kiev that he was abusing children in a nightclub in Kiev recently, in July. Okay, now that's just an allegation that hasn't been tested in court, but somebody who was in the nightclub has said yes, he was there and he was abusing children in that nightclub.
It doesn't mean anything, does it, until it goes to court? Again, it's just scurrilous nonsense.
Okay, but the thing is that I agree with you that that there should be some procedures surrounding all of this, but we all know that there isn't, and if you haven't got any money, you can't do that. And you can be accused, you know, like your man there from Wiltshire, he didn't have enough money to pay his way out of it, and he had to just back down. And that's why they do all this.
So
they're trying to control the narrative.
Of the wider question here, which is really about Russell, whether the genie can be put back into the bottle with Russell Brand. It's, you know, is this going to work as an operation to shut the guy down without actually blowing his head off?
Well, the reason why they do all of this stuff is because it does work. That's why they do it. They carry out false flag terrorist attacks. They carry out smears campaigns against individuals like Jeremy Corbyn. Some people are just done in, like Cathy McCarthy, who was a leading Sinn Féin activist, age 23, shot dead in the Queen's University bar in Belfast. The reality is that power does what power does, and you resist power in whatever means by whatever means you can. This is going on. We're in the middle of it. It's all around us. And as soon as you see it and you sense it, you can't not see it. And that is what happens. At certain points, suddenly lots of people can see through it all at once. And that may happen as we go forward, because we're in a very, very tumultuous times and they're trying an awful lot of stuff on.
MTV apparently fired Russell Brand for arriving to work dressed as Osama bin Laden a day after 9/11.
Well, you know, they can hire and fire whoever they like on that basis. It's not illegal to do it, but it's up to, you know, if you do that and your employer doesn't like it, then you're in trouble, aren't you?
In 2008, the New York Times reports Brand showed up at MTV dressed as Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda leader. There are various sort of, but I mean, when we actually get down to the nitty-gritty, the criminal allegations, I mean, the thing is, the guy's a comedian, and to me, it shouldn't matter if you turn up dressed as Osama bin Laden. What you're saying is you're just poking fun at the official narrative, and it seems to me he's one of the quote-unquote celebrities who's been doing that for decades.
Well, I totally agree, and of course, as far as I'm concerned, he can turn up dressed however he wants to be dressed. But MTV is a corporation owned by BlackRock and Vanguard, undoubtedly, and they don't see it in that light, do they? And they've got the power to sack people, and they do.
So do you think that this is going to actually work for Russell Brand in giving him more publicity? Because there's certainly lots of young men, particularly the under 30s, are big followers of Brand, and they also don't trust the BBC and they don't watch television either.
Well, I must admit, I'm extremely suspicious about all of this, but on the other hand, it may well be that he has indeed engaged in things which would be criminal. But if they are criminal, then the people who are alleging this need to go to the police, as was made clear in your interview. I can't, why would you go to Channel 4 to talk about stuff like this? If you think you've been raped, which is a very serious allegation, you go to the police. Of course, there's a big issue about whether any police will do anything, but that you don't go to the newspapers with stuff like that unless there's some malicious intent.
Right, well, we have mentioned briefly 9/11 there. So let's go on to our next item, which is about the 22nd anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And I did pick up this week that Matt Campbell, who lost his brother Jeff in the Twin Towers, he's in the middle of a judicial review. He's due to hear on Monday from the Department of Justice in the UK here as to whether he's going to get a proper inquest for his brother. What's happened is the authorities here in the UK keep sending him letters saying, oh, we don't think it's credible that the buildings that killed your brother were brought down by explosives. It must have been the planes. There's an official narrative, blah, blah, blah. So, but he's just he's a very dogged chap, and he's going to keep going with all of this. So I spoke to Matt earlier this week. And also, by the way, he's going to be on Saturday week. He's going to be in London doing a talk about his situation with his brother. He's going to be, you know, obviously making some sort of report or announcement about how his judicial review has turned out by then. And so let's have a listen now to, you know, brother, the judicial review about his brother Jeff's inquest, because this is a UK inquest, just to make it clear, because the body, once it's repatriated here, of his brother Jeff, there is an inquest into what killed him. It's obviously some sort of violent death, and he's trying to get the inquest reopened.
The test that they're supposed to apply, I mean, they're supposed to apply the law in, you know, in making those decisions. The language, I mean, the letter was very brief that they gave us. In fact, there was no real detail as to why they were denying an application. They had strange phrases like, you know, the attacks were thoroughly investigated by the FBI and the National Commissioner, you know, the 9/11 Commission report. And these conclusions are widely known and accepted, and it was reasonable for the coroner to rely on them. I mean, apart from the fact, you know, they aren't widely accepted by a lot of people, what was actually placed in front of the coroner in terms of evidence that, you know, ultimately she's looking at the causation and why and how my brother came about his death. There was no evidence whatsoever about how the towers came down in either the one page, I may add, FBI investigation that was put in front of the coroner, and nor in the two pages of cut and paste, which primarily was just the timeline of events from the National Commission report. And so it's just, you know, to say that they rely on that, where they're not actually offering any evidence whatsoever. We know that there was no inquiry done at all. I mean, nothing in terms of how my brother came about his death. There's also irrational things that the Attorney General said about how, you know, the expert eyewitness evidence and expert evidence about pre-planted explosives would make a meaningful difference to the verdict or shed further light on how the deceased came about his death. I mean, these are irrational things to say, because clearly if explosives were used, and, you know, they may have actually directly killed my brother, or certainly brought down the tower, which then obviously killed him along with others, to say that it would not make a difference to the verdict is ridiculous. They also made other arguments, which is things like the assessment of the hypothesis of whether the Twin Towers collapsed due to pre-planted explosives is simply beyond the scope of an inquest and would be unlikely to yield a different conclusion or narrative verdict. I mean, again, that's just ridiculous. You know, it's well within the responsibilities and capabilities of a UK coroner. Their task in every case is to examine, you know, in a full, fair and fearless way an inquiry of all the facts and circumstances that may show what caused, you know, any given death, and obviously in this case my brother. Basically the statement they gave us, or the reasons why, is just, it's unlawful and irrational because it's not within a reasonable range of responses to the evidence that we presented. And there's a whole bunch of sort of, you know, very dry legalese, arguments that the barristers made as to why, you know, the decision needs to be, reversed. So, I mean, right now, you know, like I said, it was sent off on the 11th. They've got 2 weeks to respond, and I'm just, you know, hopeful, because on paper we win this all day long, that they back down.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what happens on Monday. That's Matt Campbell there speaking about his inquest into his brother Jeff, who died in the 9/11 attacks. And we're going to hear from George Samueli in a minute, Martin, about 9/11, about, you know, the effects today. He thinks that the United States hasn't really paid any kind of real price for the 9/11 attacks, that they've got away with it. What do you make of it?
Well, obviously, my considered opinion is it was an inside job by the security forces working with the Israelis and all the rest of it. And you know, they do these things, as I said earlier, because they work. They created the necessary fear for the war on terror to be launched, for us to invade Afghanistan. What a success that's turned into. And then led to the destruction of various other countries subsequently. So, you know, the reason they do these things is because from their point of view, this works. That's why they keep doing it. And they don't get punished either. And then, you know, if they got punished for the Bologna bomb, for example, in 1980, and generals were sent to prison for life, then they might think twice, but they don't get sent to prison for life, so on they go.
Yeah, but there is surely a kind of spiritual price to be paid, or a psychic price to be paid, because the United States has lost a lot of its credibility around the world. In fact, there are all sorts of other organisations which have now grown up to, shall we say, box in big US institutions like the IMF and the US financial might and muscle. And many people, I mean, I think there's just this difficult to quantify the lack of trust there now is in the US-led Anglo-Zionist empire.
Well, I think what's happened is it takes a long time for the forces, you know, when you carry out a coup de main like that, which is so brutal and kills so many people and starts, you know, wars which kill millions more, you can be overwhelmed by it. But of course, ultimately, they've run out of road. Who have now got the Russian army teaching them a lesson in the Ukraine. And it's quite clear that even if NATO turned up mob-handed in the Ukraine, they would be smashed. NATO, in fact, is the number two in the world hierarchy of military power. Russia is now number one. And the Russians, knowing everything they know, because of course they know a lot more about these things than we do, because they've got resources to look into it, they have taken their time, measured their punch, and they've punched them very hard in the face, and they really don't know what to do now. And of course, that's how these things are settled, not through the courts, on battlefields.
The NATO missiles that slammed into the Russian Navy's headquarters in Sevastopol earlier today after the break. But let's have a listen now to George Samueli from Czech Republic. He's based in Prague. See what he has to say about whether or not the United States paid a price over the 9/11 attacks.
The behavior of the United States in the aftermath of 9/11 was indeed very, very strange. I mean, the perpetrator, according to the administration, according to the official line of George W. Bush, the perpetrator was Osama bin Laden. So why exactly did the United States invade Iraq? What does bin Laden have to do with Iraq? I mean, Iraq, Saddam Hussein was a secular leader. He was a Ba'athist. He hated jihadis. He hated al-Qaeda. He had nothing to do with al-Qaeda. How did it come about that within 18 months of those attacks, the United States was invading Iraq and blaming Iraq ludicrously for responsibility for the 9/11 attacks? But, you know, if you raise any of these issues, then, you know, you were a conspiracy theorist. I don't know that the United States has lost that much credibility overall, because the places that you listed, they never really thought highly of the United States. They never really trusted the United States even before the 9/11 attacks. I mean, they saw the war in Indochina, which was a very, very brutal war, in many ways far more brutal than what the United States did to Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, it really pummeled the Vietnamese. And so, you know, many people in the non-European world were obviously very distrustful of the United States. But at the same time, you have to look at it, well, the United States now has consolidated its alliances much more strongly than it ever had before. I mean, NATO, and that means the European Union and their various allies around the world, you know, the Japans, the South Koreas, the Australias, they are more embedded within the U.S. security framework than they have ever been. The United States blew up the Nord Stream gas pipeline, the pipeline that was supposed to provide natural gas to Germany. Germany, its closest ally in Europe, the great economic power of Europe. And what was the consequence? The Germans said nothing. They sat on their hands and accepted it. If you're in that position, that you don't even get complaints when you do something so terroristic.
Something here, because you made an interesting point.
Really paid a price.
Yeah, so George is saying he doesn't think the US has really paid a price. And in a way, from a military point of view, I suppose he's right.
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, they do these things because from their point of view, they work. What they've been able to do is pull their close allies, in other words, the Five Eyes countries and Germany and the EU, into line. Nobody dares to challenge them within that sphere. But, of course, outside that sphere, they don't have the same effect. And, you know, ultimately, these things are, you know, we're talking about warfare here. And of course, they've got loads of advantages. They're in a powerful position. They at one stage were doing they were initiating stuff, and everybody else is reacting to what they're doing. But we're now moving into another phase of World War III where they're going to be on the defensive, and the Russians are outsmarting them in every possible way.
I think, you may be right. And the Chinese, they're kind of inscrutable. And
they've woken up to the danger. They were trying to be nice to them and not going to bother anymore.
They're able to counter almost. I think it's fascinating with Putin. If you look at, you know, he started as president over in Russia just a year before the 9/11 attacks. And he has spent much of that time being friendly with the West, you know, joining their various clubs, trying to say, well, yeah, we just want to trade with you. But in the meantime, behind his back, he's been building up the Russian military and ensuring that it could take on the United States, take on the NATO, and potentially win in a world war.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's the good news. I mean, they've taken their time to respond because, you know, they didn't want to do anything before they were ready. There's no point trying, you know, there's no point going off at half cock with these things. If you're dealing with somebody as dangerous as they are, you've got to really think very carefully about what your moves are going to be. It's like police officers trying to take down some big criminal organisation. If you move too soon, you're gonna fail. You've got to wait until you've actually got them in the corner you want them in, and then you move against them.
One of the big consequences of 9/11 has been this whole sort of focus on terrorism. I think it was in 1986 or so that Benjamin Netanyahu came out with his book Terrorism, How the West Can Win, which seems to be almost a blueprint for this world of creating this threat of terrorism and then starting to accuse all sorts of human rights groups of being terrorist groups, and actually state actors such as the Iranian Republican Guard outfit as a terrorist group, starting to talk about the Wagner Group as a terrorist group. I mean, what they're doing is they're sanctioning the national, and Hezbollah is another one. I mean, there are quite a few around the world now where it's actually associated with an elected organization, an elected government. even, where they're now being called terrorists. Well, this is a bit of a game they seem to be playing. So this is specifically, let's specifically look at the way this is relating to the Israel-Palestine situation. And Al Jazeera, this is the second over, I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I used the first clip of several that Al Jazeera have been transmitting documentaries inside Israel's surveillance machine. It's a program called The Listening Post on Al Jazeera. And let's have a look now about this Al-Haq human rights group and how they're being demonized as terrorists by the Israelis and also put under extreme surveillance. So let's have a listen to a clip from that documentary now.
The Israeli government's demonization of Al-Haq reached a peak in October 2021. That's when Rula Jamal's colleague, a field researcher in Jerusalem, alerted her that something strange was going on with his phone.
He comes to my office, I'm his supervisor. He says his phone is acting weird. His friend calls him saying, I have been trying to call you back, but you are not picking up. My colleague tells him, but I never called you. And then he says, no, you did. And he actually takes a screenshot from his phone log, sends it to my colleague, and then my colleague also does the same. And these two logs are different. And that's when he literally panicked, because it is, well, it's not normal to your phone to be making calls by itself.
An investigation eventually revealed Jamal's colleague had been targeted with Pegasus, spyware made by the notorious Israeli company NSO Group. 3 days after the hacking, Israel designated Al-Haq and five other human rights groups terrorist organizations. Then Al-Haq's offices were raided by the Israeli military. The building's CCTV recorded some soldiers searching through documents. Others were just there to take trophy photos and group selfies. Al-Haq cannot be certain who is responsible for hacking them. What's clear is that their work documenting Israeli war crimes is being monitored and has made them a target.
We are worried about falsified evidence, because Pegasus is a zero-click technology, which means that you're not required to interact with any message or a link or anything. It just actually enters into your phone without you noticing anything. So if this technology is able to actually falsify an entire interface and an entire log, what else can it do? We have been told that political prisoners, upon their release, one of their exit conversations, which is usually done by an Israeli intelligence officer, they are being explicitly asked to get themselves a smartphone. One of the people that we have spoken to actually didn't get a phone the first 10 days, and he was summoned and reminded about getting a phone as soon as possible, or they would get one for him. So there's not even any shame. It's out there, it's in the open, that yes, we are constantly monitoring you, and it is your duty to actually go get the device that we use to surveil every single part of your life.
The Israeli intelligence outfit responsible for this kind of spying is Unit 8200. Based just outside Tel Aviv, the work 8200 does is highly secretive, and its recruitment highly selective. Most of the people who work there are 18 to 21-year-olds. In a country that likes to brand itself a startup nation, Unit 8200 is seen as an incubator of technological talent. Many Israelis aspire to do their military service there with the knowledge that it could later help them land a job at a major tech firm. However, behind the unit's slick, high-tech image is the reality of surveillance work that can be far more sinister. Eli was a lieutenant in the unit. He spoke to us on the condition that we hide his identity.
They give you this impression that you're the best of the best.
you're told you're defending your country, and only select people know the things that you know. And it's kind of mind-boggling how intimate you are with people that are total strangers, sometimes very important people. So it's hard to resist this sense of superiority. And you have a lot of power for an 18-year-old. You can start eavesdropping on someone just because you decided to. You can pass on his name and change his life. So it has this intoxicating feeling of power.
The former lieutenant is one of a small group of 8200 veterans who refused to continue their service because, in their words, they no longer wanted to be tools in the deepening military control over Palestinians.
The secrecy around 8200 and the intelligence community in general helps it avoid public inspection. It has this image of only collecting information, only preventing terrorism, so on, only diminishing violence, not in any way perpetuating it. But that's not true. As we know from other military regimes around the world, intelligence is an integral part of a forced control over people.
It's illegal for Unit 8200 to target Israeli citizens, but not Palestinians. That's because the unit operates in what it calls foreign arenas. Iran is considered one arena, Syria another. And then there are Palestinians, as if they were a foreign adversary, not an indigenous occupied population. One of the most effective ways to monitor Palestinians is to turn them against each other, by blackmailing them into becoming collaborators. It's a particularly corrosive technique that creates distrust within communities, and it relies on finding people's vulnerabilities.
You always look for weaknesses. People with psychological difficulties or trust issues, stuff like that. If we have compromising material, we use that in order to force them into cooperation. So, for instance, someone who is homosexual, that is something that can be used against him. Officers are even taught different vocabulary for how to say gay in Arabic to identify these people and pass them on. Also, if someone or their family has a medical problem, we can offer them treatment or prevent them from getting treatment to blackmail cooperation. So any kind of weakness that we can use in order to get this first connection and cooperation. Obviously, once you get that, you put the person at double the risk because now he's a traitor. So you have even more control over him.
Well, fascinating, isn't it? I think, Martin, how something, you know, basically this is a human rights group that they're discussing there and all sorts of techniques to shut them down, and yet they've been branded terrorists in Israel. I mean, this is becoming the norm now. This is just a word that you throw at somebody that you think, you know, might be in competition with you or politically. I mean, it's become an incredibly politicized term.
Well, it always was, really, wasn't it? I mean, were the French resistance terrorists? Well, according to the Germans, they were. But according to themselves, they weren't.
Well, they always used to say, didn't they, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist.
That's right. And this is the old Irish joke, how do you know which ones are the terrorists? They're the ones with the little bombs.
It's got to, in many ways, it's very similar to this Russell Brand stuff, just chucking round unsubstantiated allegations. And particularly when it comes to human rights groups in Palestine, absolutely impossible for the local people to survive without having some kind of document, as he said in the documentary there, to actually document abuses of international law is now considered a terrorist offence by the Israeli government.
Well, more to the point is the way they use knowledge of individuals to entrap them. Annie Masham told us years ago that in MI5 they were taught there were four ways in which to get people to do what you want, and then the acronym was MICE: money, ideology, coercion, ego. And I presume that, you know, these techniques are universal. And have been used for many hundreds of years, but obviously, we've now got a whole industry of people using these techniques to coerce, targeted groups, targeted political parties, targeted individuals. We're surrounded by this 100% of the time, aren't we?
Well, we've been plunged into, it seems to me, a security state. That's effectively what's going on. So, you know, I look at this in the context of international affairs, and I think, well, they're planning a third world war. They're planning a war with Russia. They're prepared to go to the line with this. It's a high-risk strategy, but they're going to make sure, as Kees van der Peel says in his book States of Emergency, they are making sure that as this cartel-based fascistic government takes over, with national governments weakened through debt and other reasons, and obviously undermined by the secret state, that they want to make sure that there is no kind of pushback domestically. And so they're starting to be this long-term war has developed, around the world between nations, but there's also this war now developing very strongly with the government actually at war with its own people and it trying to still call itself a democracy, but it just won't wash. And what we were just hearing from Unit 8200 in Israel, as you said earlier on, Martin, I just want to go back to that for a minute. The lawyers have been complaining for the last few years to Labour after hiring an ex-Israeli intelligence officer. A legal firm say the party's stance on illegal occupation of Palestine should have stopped the staff members' employment. So lawyers acting for a Palestinian activist and Labour member have complained to the party over its decision to hire a former Israeli intelligence officer, Asaf Kaplan, as a social listening and organising manager. Post described as crucial new role at the heart of Labour's new approach to digital campaigning. The complaint from Bindmans alleges that Kaplan worked for Unit 8200, the cyber branch of the Israeli Defence Force, from 2009 to 2013, adding that the unit had been mired in controversy over its surveillance practices against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank and Gaza. So it does look, doesn't it, as if Keir Starmer is deliberately going out and finding people who have undermined human rights. I mean, even though he's supposed to be a human rights lawyer with this so-called MacLibel legacy, in order to just roll this kind of Israeli-style intelligence out across Britain, that looks rather likely.
Well, I think it's a slam dunk, isn't it? That is exactly what's happening. Where this may come unstuck politically is that despite all the propaganda, the Israeli state isn't actually that popular in Britain, not just amongst Muslims, but amongst the general population. When they invaded Lebanon in 2006, and of course Hezbollah defeated the Israeli Defense Forces in 2006, they used Kornet anti-tank weaponry to take out the Merkava tanks, which the Israelis were using, and they couldn't make any headway into Lebanon, which previously they'd been able to do without much problem. Stopped the war, got massive amounts of money and support when the Israelis invaded Lebanon. And I think what may well happen with the Labour government, if we get one, is that the Israelis will do something like that, and then the government will be on the spot, because in actual fact they'll be on the wrong side of the argument. I say already on the wrong side of the argument. They're opposed to boycott, disinvestment and sanctions, which is in fact what the apartheid Israeli state should be subjected to, according to many decent Israeli activists, never mind the Palestinians.
Yeah, which is what anyone would say if he was involved in the anti-apartheid South African claims of back from the 1980s and 1990s. They would say the same thing. A loose network of intelligence firms with names like Black Cube and NSO Group have their profits effectively subsidised by the Israeli taxpayer in the form of what amounts to free government training for their recruits. Unit 8200 veterans flood the world of high-tech startups in Israel. Unit 8200 is itself notorious as a particularly brutal and insidious spying outfit, says Asa Win Stanley in the Middle East Monitor. In 2014, a group of anonymous whistleblowers revealed the details of just how all-pervading the spying apparatus that dominates Palestinian life in the West Bank really is. One of the whistleblowers said, "When I enlisted into the intelligence unit, I thought I would deal with prevention of terrorism and do what was necessary to protect national security. On the contrary, I discovered that Israeli initiatives within the Palestinian arena are directed at things that are nothing related to intelligence. I worked on gathering information on political issues. I had a really hard time with some of the things that we did." Another whistleblower said they had systematically just there to gather information that seems irrelevant from a security standpoint. I did not have a clear conscience participating in these activities. Contrary to my expectations, our database included not only security intelligence, but also personal political information, which then could be used for targeting people politically. So the idea is, if you don't, is this a thought police, effectively, isn't it? Behind the scenes, Martin.
Yes, and it's not just a thought police. They also engage in terrorism in order to create the necessary psychological effects. And then all this other stuff is a sort of second tap, well, mopping up operation. Behind, you know, the idea that these people are protecting society from evil is laughable, isn't it?
Yeah, so we seem to be not only borrowing from the United States the worst practices over there, these fascistic practices of political control, but also from the Israelis. Anyway, let's go back to the main story this week, which is Matt Campbell and the announcement beginning of next week about the inquest into his brother Jeff's death, murder, he says, in the Twin Towers. And so he's going to be speaking next Saturday in Camden, and he explains what's going on.
And it's been a busy time. I've been involved on a slightly different matter with a new film that's come out about Graham McQueen's life, who's a sort of key 9/11 researcher, both on the anthrax attacks, but also in particular the eyewitness statements of first responders who were witness to, either use words like explosions, explosives, bombs, etc. In their testimony that was taken from them in the days after 9/11. And so my actual brother-in-law is the editor and co-director, along with Ted Walter, who's from an organization called the International Center for 9/11 Justice, ic911.org. and I did some a little bit of additional research for the film, but I'm actually going to be speaking at an event the end of this month, on the 30th, in Camden at the Pirate Castle, strange place in Camden, where there's going to be a showing of the film. I'm going to be talking and obviously giving an update of hopefully good news from what we've heard from the Attorney General. And there's also the propaganda expert, Piers Robinson, who's speaking there. So anyway, you can find tickets for it on Eventbrite. If you just search for either my name, Matt Campbell, or I think it's called The Official Story Versus the Truth. But, you know, it's the run up to the anniversary is always busy for me. I mean, less so, I get less requests from mainstream media now, to speak, probably because they know what I'm going to talk about. But it is always, there's always something going on, and this year's, you know, not been any different. And, it's just obviously if you've got this additional thing of all the legal stuff going on in the background that's on my mind constantly at the moment.
Matt Campbell there. And finally, I asked Matt about the how much it had cost. I mean, obviously, this is one of the main reasons why people don't pursue what they know to be true, is because they're dissuaded because of the lack of access to the legal system. Well, I mean, you know, what we're seeing in the West, of course, particularly in the UK, with the cost of living crisis and also with the destruction of legal aid by people like Ken Clark, the Conservative MP who was Justice Secretary when they got rid of legal aid not long after the 2010 elections. The idea is to really just shut most people out of the judicial process and make it too expensive to do anything like this. But anyway, Matt has been quite successful with crowdfunding all this, so I asked him about how much it had all cost.
The only reason I've been able to do this is through the generosity of people who, you know, care about the truth, care about what went on that day, and, you know, believe that we haven't heard the truth. And this is only just one aspect of the attacks. So I've been very lucky. You know, people all around the world have donated. There's a donate button on ic911.org, which, you know, I'm hoping we don't need to keep pushing that, because I'm hoping that the Attorney General backs down and we can actually go ahead and get a new inquest for my brother. And it would be, you know, the first time that evidence of the use of explosives and incendiaries would ever be put into a court. You know, because every other attempt to do this has failed. And I said even sort of more accepted, I guess if you want to call it that, court, legal cases, whether it be the Guantanamo Bay hearings or the Saudi lawsuits, that they're not going anywhere, you know. And so this to me is the first opportunity to get, you know, I call it sort of 9/11 litigation, to actually get it into a court, even though it's in the UK and it isn't in the US. But I think that works in my favour to some extent.
Yeah, well, how much can I ask? How much, you know, has been ploughed into this legal case so far?
It's horrendous. I mean, it's proper lawfare. So the initial application, you know, which we worked on for about a year, was £80,000. The judicial review and filing is £48,000. But I know from speaking to someone who, an unrelated case, but they have been through a similar, you know, set of obstacles placed for them through the legal system. They actually went through the judicial review process. At every single stage, the other party could have capitulated, but they didn't. They eventually won their case, but it took 5 years and £200,000. And that, to me, is just disgusting that, you know, whether you've got the money or not, that's how much you have to spend and how much time needs to pass before you get any semblance of justice. But I said I'm very lucky and grateful that people have been supporting my fight.
So that's Matt Campbell speaking to me earlier this week about his event that he's putting on next Saturday in Camden at the Pirate Shop, I think he called it. So, but Martin, I mean, this is what we talked about earlier about Starmer back in around about 2000, saying how important it was that we've got to keep legal aid, otherwise people don't have access to justice. Well, I wonder is he going to do anything about it when he comes to power next year?
I'm not holding my breath, Tony. Are you?
Certainly not. No, it's just you know, this is why I think that the guy is so utterly untrustworthy, like many other politicians. You know, the idea that we're going to get anything different with Starmer is a joke. I think we'll basically be crossing our fingers, holding our noses and trying to vote for some change. But all we're going to get is the same old nonsense. And also this week, in fact, just today, 9/11 defendant has been announced to be unfit to stand trial, ruled by an American judge and the BBC website. A military judge at Guantanamo Bay has ruled one of the five defendants charged over the 9/11 attacks is not fit to stand trial in a death penalty case. The defendant, Ramzi bin al-Sib, has been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and associated psychotic features and delusional disorder. Maybe he's deluded enough to think that he's going to get justice. God, who knows? Anyway, his lawyer has long claimed that his client has been tortured by the CIA. He's scheduled to face pretrial proceedings today. But Colonel Matthew McCall, in the US base on the eastern tip of Cuba, accepted the findings of the doctors, who said in August that al-Sib was too psychologically damaged to defend himself. The medical board of the doctors concluded he'd become delusional and psychotic, as reported in the New York Times. So he's supposed to be in trial today, but the five men are accused of conspiring in the plane hijackings of 2001 that nearly killed 3,000 people in New York, at the Pentagon, and in Pennsylvania, Martin.
Well, it stinks to high heaven, the whole thing, doesn't it? You've got a military base on Cuba, which the Cubans have never accepted should be there, but the Americans insist that they're allowed to have it. You know, the Cubans could legitimately just run them off there, you know, in international law. And then they've got a military tribunal that decides they're going to put on trial people they say did it, even though all the evidence points to a completely different conclusion about what happened. And then when they finally decide that he could go to court, obviously if he came to court, then it would come out that probably he had nothing to do with it, and it was probably some completely different set of people who were behind it all. So the easiest way to deal with that, and don't forget he's been held in defiance of habeas corpus since 9/11, which is 23 years, you know, they probably arrested him soon afterwards. It's just appalling. And, the dogs in the street in Colombia, for example, can see what this system is. The dogs in the street can see it. Nevertheless, you know, the comfortable people in the developed world in this country and in the United States still live in delusions about what kind of country they live in.
Didn't we, from the former SAS soldier Ben Griffin, that they were given bounties to go and just arrest any old person when they were sent over to into the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Al-Sib is from Yemen and 51 years old. He was arrested in Pakistan in September 2002 and transferred to Guantanamo Bay in 2006. So there's been no tests whatsoever on whether he had anything to do with anything. And it's not he's not even entered into even U.S. Jurisdiction, into their legal jurisdiction at all. He's been, you know, at arm's length, being controlled by the military. His lawyers said he was tortured by the CIA and he went insane as a result of what the agency called enhanced interrogation techniques, including long-term sleep deprivation, waterboarding and beatings.
Yes, and of course, Guantanamo Bay is just the tip of the iceberg. There are possibly hundreds of illegal prisons that are being run by our government and the American government all over the world. And some of them, for example, were in Poland, in Lithuania, in Ukraine. Some of them were in Egypt. Some of them at one stage were in Syria before we fell out with Assad. Because what they used to do is they say, you know, they will say, right, we're going to send you to Libya and Gaddafi will torture you. Because he was this is a whole, you know, you can imagine what they can create out of that. It creates a huge intimidation of Muslims who might be swept up in it, and it also allows them to create out of whole cloth new terrorist organisations like ISIS, which they control. And then they say, "Oh, we've got to do something about ISIS." Well, yeah, one thing you could do about ISIS is not create it in the first place.
Many of the people who were detained in Guantanamo were also then released, weren't they, as moles and agents by the CIA. His mental situation has been an issue, apparently, since his first court appearance in 2008, where he disrupted some of the hearings with outbursts. Well, that doesn't necessarily sound to me as if he's mentally ill. I mean, if you're put into a courtroom, which is a complete and utter farce, and a kangaroo court, I think there's quite a lot of people who accuse him that who might have outbursts too, Martin.
Well, indeed. And of course, you know, being held for 23 years in the most appalling conditions and being tortured for something you probably got no idea about at all, well, you know, it's virtually guaranteed to have an effect on your psychological health, isn't it?
Accusations against him is helping to organise an Al-Qaeda cell in Hamburg, Germany, that hijacked one of two passenger jets that crashed into the World Trade Center. Well, I mean, what you and I know of the 9/11 narrative, first of all, the first point to make has got to be, well, these passenger jets, there's a lot of evidence that they were actually being flown by remote control and there was nobody in them hijacking anything.
Well, that's right. I mean, the hijackers didn't have any, you know, relevant training to fly such jets. And the jets themselves did not fly directly to the targets. They flew around all over the place, which implies that somebody was steering them from the ground, because you can't fly on sight at that at 30,000 feet. You've got to fly on instruments, and if you're flying on instruments, you just fly directly to where you can't just fly around all over the place. You don't know where you are. There's so many holes in the story after all these years that you'd have thought people would have worked. But what tends to happen is people, oh, that was a long time ago. It's not relevant now. But I tell you who it is relevant for: the Russian general staff, the Iranian general staff, who pointed out that one of the planes was actually the one that supposedly crashed at Shanksville, was absolutely stuffed. Every single person on that plane had a connection to the Pentagon, which is totally impossible as a random thing. And of course, what's actually happening is the opponents of the Western deep state, they know an awful lot more about this than we do. And of course, they've drawn the relevant conclusions. They know what they're up against. They're fighting World War III. They intend to win.
We'll finish part one with this report on the BBC News about Chris Cabba. He was murdered by the Metropolitan Police. I mean, he hadn't actually done anything. He was just pulled over by the police and shot dead. And it's nice to see that now Keir Starmer is not in charge of the Crown Prosecution Service, that the police officer involved, it looks as if, will be charged with murder. So let's have a listen to the Chris Cabba report now.
A Metropolitan Police officer is to be charged with the murder of Chris Cabba, an unarmed black man who was shot through a car windscreen in South London a year ago. Mr. Cabba's death sparked protests and reignited accusations of racism against the force. His family have welcomed the decision to bring a murder charge and reiterated their desire to see justice served. More from our correspondent, Greg McKenzie.
Almost exactly a year ago, Chris Cabba was shot dead by a Metropolitan Police officer in South London. He was 24 years old, just months away from becoming a father. His death sparked a number of protests, particularly among London's black community. He was being followed by an unmarked police car in Streatham before he was brought to a stop. The Audi car, which was not his, had been flagged by a police automatic number plate recognition camera as being linked to an incident the previous day. He was hit by a single bullet fired into the vehicle. Mr. Cabba himself was unarmed. The Independent Office for Police Conduct investigated the shooting and handed their evidence to the Crown Prosecution Service almost 7 months ago. Mr. Cabba's family spoke to the BBC earlier this month on the anniversary of their son's death. Here's his mum, Helen Cabba.
So what about us? What about us? When I have to do the proper mourning for Chris, it's very disappointing, very. So we demand to the CPS, we need a decision.
The Crown Prosecution Service has now authorised a charge of murder against the officer who fired the gun. In a statement, the Deputy Assistant Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Helen Millichap, said it was a significant and serious development, but it would be inappropriate to say any more until the court process had run its course. The officer involved in the shooting will be formally charged tomorrow and will then appear at Westminster Magistrates Court. He has not been named for unspecified legal reasons and remains suspended.
An extraordinary report, Martin. I think what we've got is a, you know, this guy basically didn't do anything. He was still in the car. Police car pulled him over, just executed him.
Yes, it sounds appalling, doesn't it? And of course, there's quite a lot of Metropolitan Police officers. They're all, you know, there's a huge turmoil going on in the Met at the moment, with lots of officers being suspended, charged with all sorts of offences. And of course, it doesn't fulfil, you know, the community can't have confidence in the Metropolitan Police as things stand. That doesn't mean we don't need a police force. It just means we need one that actually knows what they're supposed to be doing, rather than randomly shooting people in cars.
I mean, it seems amazing that some police seems to think that this is, you know, there are various headlines out there. Is officers are anxious after the marksman murder charge. The police marksman is charged with Chris Cabba's murder. I mean, they haven't obviously got the right people in these jobs. We've at least maybe got a Metropolitan Commissioner now who is starting to actually take some action against these maniacs who've managed to become police officers.
Well, that's right, and it's an ongoing struggle. I mean, back in the 70s when Sir Robert Mark took over the Met, he gave a press conference where he said, I've got some good news and bad news. The bad news is that hundreds of my police officers are criminals. The good news is we know which ones they are and we're keeping an eye on them. And that is basically how policing operates. It's, you know, the honest coppers have got to keep control of the dishonest ones. And, of course, there is also political agendas and so on. If Chris Cabba had been white, would this officer have just shot him in the way that he did? And the answer is probably no.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously there's a racial aspect to this. Black guy just killed by the police in he hadn't apparently done anything. What the police have said, and of course this will come out in court now, thank God, that there is actually going to be some proper charges against this. I mean, I remember Kevin Carhill telling us, who's a former soldier in the British Army and the Irish Army, as well as the wonderful journalist that he is, that he was convinced that that there was a rather nasty aspect to both in the armed forces and in the police to deliberately recruiting psychopaths.
Well, if you think about it, certainly in the army, that's one. It's almost like one of the things they're looking for. And you know, it's an inevitability that you're going to attract these kind of people. Look, you know, I mean, look at the nurse that killed all those babies in the hospital in Chester. I mean, she obviously decided to be a nurse because she was actually, you know, desiring to kill babies. And you can't, you know, you can do some things to weed these people out. But of course, it's to do with the internal culture of organisations, isn't it? I mean, look what the SAS, the Australian SAS, certainly, and probably British and New Zealand SAS were doing in Afghanistan. They were going out and killing people at random, you know, pretending that they found them with grenades and weaponry, and the internal culture of the SAS was that this is what we do, and nobody's ever going to pull us up on this, and up to now nobody has, although there has been a court case in Australia where this guy took the newspapers in Australia to court to claim that they were making false allegations against him, and he lost. And of course, he lost because he did indeed do all the things that were alleged. And it looks as if you know, hundreds of others were also involved. Are we going to disband all of our special forces, put them in prison? Maybe we should.
If you or I had executed a man sitting in a car through the windscreen by shooting him dead, even though he hadn't actually done anything, or that there was no real expectation that he had a gun, which he didn't, then you would expect that we would at least be named in court. This police officer behind all this may obviously be an ex-army, but he has not been named. Apparently, there's no. The judge won't explain why he's not going to name him, but he still hasn't been named. It may be that the family don't even know what his name is, who is left after Chris Cabba's execution.
Well, I mean, what the BBC report was saying, there are legal reasons why he hasn't been named. Well, I'd like to know what those legal reasons are.
If you were to do an internet search on this guy's name, you might find him cropping up elsewhere. Anyway, look, we've got a lot to talk about in part two, mainly looking at this latest assault on the headquarters of the Russian Navy's Black Sea Fleet in Crimea, in Sevastopol, plus a specific look at nuclear weapons and nuclear safety. Might be appropriate link between the two. Goodness only knows. Obviously, there are a lot of Russian nukes in Sevastopol, and they will be most likely... Well, I'm not even sure that the Russians have deployed nuclear weapons to the Black Sea, but that's certainly a possibility as of now, if there is a more of an outbreak. And also, Martin, I want to hear from you, because I know you've been on RT again this week talking about relations between Ukraine and Poland. So we'll come to that after the break.
Got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You got to spread joy up to the maximum, bring gloom down to the minimum, have faith or pandemonium, liable to walk upon the sea.
To illustrate his last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark. What did they do just when everything looked so dark?
Man, they said we better accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. No, do not mess with Mr. In-Between. Do you hear me?
Chillin' Anna, you will hear about the eliminating of the negative and an accent on a positive.
Gather round me, children, if you're willing, and sit tight while I start reviewing the attitude of doing right.
You gotta accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between.
Got to spread joy
up to the maximum.
Bring gloom
down
to the minimum.
Then
otherwise, pandemonium liable to walk upon the scene.
To illustrate,
well, illustrate
my last remark.
You got the floor.
Jonah
in the whale, Noah
in the ark. What did they say?
What did they say?
Say when everything looks so dark. Said we better accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative. Latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. No, don't mess with Mr. In-Between.
Ezekiel cried.
Dry
bones.
Ezekiel cried. Dry
bones.
Ezekiel cried,
dry bones, now hear the word of the Lord. Ezekiel connected them, dry bones, Ezekiel connected them, dry bones, Ezekiel connected them, dry bones, now hear the word of the Lord. Oh, when your toe bone connected to your foot bone connected to your heel bone connected to your ankle bone connected to you. Leg bone connected to you. Knee bone connected to you. Thigh bone connected to you. Hip bone connected to you. Back bone connected to you. Shoulder bone connected to you. Neck bone connected to you. Head bone, now hear the word of the Lord. Them bones gonna walk around them.
20 years. That's what he goes there for, is to unlock the door. Well, those around him criticize and sleep. Through a fractal on a breaking wall, I see you, my friend, and touch your face again. Miracles will happen as we trip. But we're never gonna survive unless we get a little crazy. No, we're never gonna survive unless we are a little crazy. Crazy people walking through my head. One of them's got a gun, shoot the other one. And yet together they were friends at school.
Back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Although, please not Google with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. What were you listening to there? Well, it was a bit of Accentuate the Positive. Which we always like to do on this program. That's so depressing. It's actually much less depressing when you understand what's really going on and the evil shenanigans out there. And these people are hiding to nothing. I hope Martin thinks that. I certainly do. That they're going to basically destroy themselves with their own greed and psychopathy. We had Accentuate the Positive with Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters. That's from 1944. Then we had Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians, a terrific version. In fact, the best version, no doubt, of Dry Bones, a little bit from Ezekiel there. plus Slow Train coming with the Doobie Brothers from 1973, and finally 1990 Seal with Crazy. So, Martin, let's get straight into this attack today in Sevastopol. Now, I mean, it's all being spun as a Ukrainian attack. You and I know that the targeting information and intelligence about all this stuff comes from the NATO satellites, and the missiles too are NATO missiles, aren't they?
Yes, I mean, the Russians have been pretty clear that they know what's going on here. The attacks on the Crimea are in a slightly different position, or they used to be in a different position than attacks within the Donbass, but the Donbass republics are now part of the Russian Federation. So attacks on the Crimea and attacks on the Donbass are being legally treated as exactly the same by the Russians. And of course, they're using NATO missiles, NATO. I mean, but effectively, the Ukrainian army is being run by NATO, and the British retain playing a particularly prominent role in all of this, which ought to give people second thoughts in this country. Well, really, do we want to go to war with Russia?
Martin, it's not a prominent role. It's basically a hidden role. Can you give us an idea of the role you think the British do have and what the evidence is for it?
Well, the previous attacks by submersible, unmanned submersibles, the Russians were saying, well, these are British, this is British kit. The Storm Shadow missiles, which are being used, that's definitely British kit. The depleted uranium that's being used is British kit. The Challenger tank, which was knocked out by a Russian Kornet missile or anti-tank missile, that's British kit. British military are on the ground, the SAS are on the ground. The actual plans for the counteroffensive, so-called, were orchestrated by the British military and the American military. The Ukrainians basically are subordinate in everything that they're doing. And the Russians, up to now, have tolerated this because, you know, they could just say at some point, right, you're fighting with us, we're going to war with you. They don't want to do that, which is why the British have been able to get away with what they've been doing. I think the British were probably involved in the murder of Zakhachenko in 2017, who was the elected Prime Minister of the Donbass Republic. As we heard the other week, he was killed by a bomb in a light fitting in a restaurant. All of which, to me, definitely suggests British military intelligence. We were talking earlier about Bucha, and the Maidan massacre. The Ukrainians are pretty evil, but a lot of what they're doing is actually orchestrated by Western intelligence services, including the British.
Martin, it's pronounced butcher, which is part of, I think, the psyop involved in that, is the idea that people think about a butcher's shop.
Well, that's anyway. Right, so it may well be. And 9/11, of course, is the number that you phone when you're phoning the police in the United States. That may have had something to do with the choice of the day, but there we go.
I don't know if you remember, but it wasn't called 9/11 straight away. I can remember in the few months directly after it was known as S11, which is even more bizarre because if you put S on top of 11, you get a giant dollar sign. So there's also maybe some sort of esoteric significance in that. But anyway, Ukraine has struck Russia's Black Sea Fleet headquarters. The Russian Black Sea Fleet came under a missile attack. Said that the missile and aviation threat in Sevastopol was over, but asked citizens to refrain from travelling to the city centre. Efforts to extinguish the fire at the Black Sea Fleet headquarters are continuing. Manpower and resources are sufficient there to do so. He's asking people to please remain calm. He said the acting deputy governor, Yevgeny Gorlov, acting director of the Public Security Department, Alexei Kraskutsky, and chief of the main director at the Ministry of Emergency Situations in Sevastopol, Major General Alexei Rokin, are performing their duties on site at the operational headquarters. Now, this is not an attack on a ship. This is an attack on a headquarters. Now, this is what I think makes it interesting, is that the United States has got its headquarters all around the world. It's got these places like EUCOM, AFRICOM, what they call the Unified Command Structure. This is exactly the sort of thing that the Russians may even now be looking at retaliating against one of these US coordinating headquarters. I just don't know. What do you think might be the effect of this and the response anyway?
Well, in the Ukraine itself, after various provocations, the Russians have in fact attacked command and control centres. Like the headquarters of the SBU, the secret police, was attacked. And I understand that various other, you know, they're looking to kill NATO officers, basically, because NATO officers are embedded within the Ukrainian command structure. And the Russians are looking to kill NATO officers if they can. But, of course, the Russians have basically fought with the gloves on most of the time. That's why they call it a special military operation rather than outright war. For example, they haven't knocked out the satellites, which are giving information to the Ukrainians for targeting. And if we go to war, those satellites will be taken down almost immediately. And then the NATO will be fighting blind. They haven't done that yet.
It seems to me that the Russians are playing this very, very cool. The idea is that even though they know that these various NATO installations are killing Russians, are attacking parts of... I mean, this is part of Russia now, Crimea. I mean, let's not forget, and it seems that the entire Western media has got a bit of a myopia or whatever on this one. But in 2014, there was a referendum in Crimea. Of course, the Western media says, when it ever dares to mention it, that it was all fixed. But, of course, they always say that about Russian votes. I mean, they even call Putin a dictator, even though he's actually an elected president.
Zelensky at the United Nations, on that point, he said the Russians are to blame because they've re-elected Putin time and again. And it's like, yes, they have, haven't they, Vladimir? That's right.
Yes, they certainly have, but they haven't re-elected Prince Charles, that's for sure. Anyway, in 2014, there was a 95.5% pro-joining Russia result there. And that is because these are all Russian-speaking people. We need to understand that this whole area of Ukraine, it looks as if over the years has been deliberately set up as a flashpoint between East and West, where there's a whole load of Russian cultural, Russian speakers in that area who have much more affinity with Russia than they do with the West anyway.
Well, that's right. I mean, like a lot of, Ukraine's only been an independent state since 1991. It was never an independent state before that, apart from a brief state that was set up by the Germans in 1918. And of course, the modern Ukraine includes parts of the West Ukraine, which were never part of Russia at all. They were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So,
wasn't it part of Poland at some point?
Yes, that's right. I mean, when I spoke on RT that yesterday evening, they were talking about relations between Poland and Russia, which have reached a quite, you know, there's a current crisis developing there, because the Poles are not happy about the Ukrainians trucking grain from Ukraine into Poland, and the same is true in Hungary and other East countries.
They're flooding the market with cheap grain. It means that the Polish farmers are going broke.
That's right. And the Polish farmers are quite influential. You know, farming is a big, you know, lots of people are still employed in farming in Poland. They've probably got the biggest agricultural population of any country in Europe because they've got all these small farmers who haven't really got any alternative other than farming. They can't just up sticks and go anywhere. So they've been kept going on a drip feed, really. But the last thing they need is loads of cheap Ukrainian grain, which is actually owned, a lot of the land in Ukraine is now owned by oligarchs from outside Ukraine, and they're losing money because of the collapse of the grain deal between Ukraine and Russia earlier in the year. And so there's an election coming up in Poland in October, and the current government is not happy. They're trying to show that their farmers, you know, they've actually defied EU rules to put sanctions to prevent Ukrainian grain coming into Poland. Obviously that's caused, you know, gnashing of teeth in Kiev. Other tensions that have developed the president of Poland, I think it said, you know, Ukraine is behaving like a drowning person and they're dragging us down with them, which is very extraordinary if you think about it. The stuff I've been reading suggests that thousands of Polish soldiers have already died in the Ukraine fighting as, you know, volunteers supposedly in the Ukrainian army. And underlying all of this was what happened in World War II when the Ukrainian insurgent army massacred up to 100,000 Poles in Volyn and around Lviv, and because the Azov battalion recently posted a video of themselves all waving Ukrainian insurgent army flags and boasting how they were a reincarnation of the Ukrainian insurgent army. Of course, in Poland, these people are remembered with horror because they killed at least 100,000 Poles, and they killed everybody, women, children. It was a pogrom against the Poles. And if you go back into history, you'll find that the antagonism between Ukrainians and Poles came about because the Ukrainians tended to be the peasants, and the Poles at one stage used to be the landowners in Galicia, which was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So, I mean, of course, it's nothing to do. I mean, that part of the country was never part of Russia until the Second World War,
anyway,
when it was captured by the Soviets.
Martin, we're going to have to crack on. The Sputnik Globe has released quite an interesting article. Military expert: NATO helped Ukraine strike the Black Sea Fleet headquarters in Sevastopol. I mean, we can go even back to the Crimean War. The Brits were involved in that. Crimea is got to be a target from a strategic point of view because of the Black Sea Fleet. Because, you know, whatever goes on in the Middle East, the Black Sea Fleet comes through, goes, obviously it's in the Black Sea, but the Russians then come through the Bosphorus and they project Russian power as a kind of counterbalance to the United States and the Anglo-Zionist Empire, don't they, in the Eastern Mediterranean?
Well, that's right, and what they hoped they could carry out with the coup in 2014 in Kiev was that they would then get Crimea as part of Ukraine. And then they would able, and there were actually, there was contracts given in by the US military to develop infrastructure like kindergartens and schools and so on for a US presence in Sevastopol. Which of course never came to pass because of the referendum that you described. You can see from the Russian point of view, I mean, Crimea has been part of Russia since the 1780s. It's been part of Russia longer than California, Texas, and Arizona have been part of the United States. All of the Western United States was captured from the Mexicans in the Mexican-American War of 1820s, in the 1820s, when basically the Americans, invaded Mexico and took over half their territory. The Russians were similarly expansive in that era, but of course the population now in Crimea is overwhelmingly Russian speaking, and they were only put into the Ukraine as a part of the Soviet Union in 1954 as an administrative decision by Khrushchev. Just as in Yugoslavia, we're now fighting over borders which were drawn up by communists for their own reasons back in the day. So there's no real historical reason for the Ukraine to be the size or shape that it actually is, same as with Yugoslavia. And therefore, everything is disputable.
Looking into the details of this attack, Per Dandikin, who's Kiev's Western military curators, and their proxies take many factors into account when planning these strikes, says one of the Russian commentators. They plan how to bypass our air defences and distract them. Everything's taken into account. How many missiles are there in our installations? How long it takes to reload and so on. The Russian military expert explained they can launch drones. Yesterday we saw a massive drone raid. It's likely that they were checking Russian air defence readiness. We repelled the strike and shot down everything. The fact is that our Black Sea sailors are ready for such situations. Now they know, don't they, all these sailors, Martin, that they're not really fighting Zelensky. They're fighting Biden.
Well, that's right. I mean, Zakharova, the Russian foreign ministry spokesperson, has made it clear, and Medvedev and various other senior Russians, they know that they're fighting NATO. The population in Russia knows that they're fighting NATO. And, of course, there is a presidential election coming up in March. Undoubtedly, Putin will stand, and his current opinion poll rating is something like 75%. So the population in Russia knows that they're fighting NATO. They know they're in for a long haul, and they're prepared to do what's necessary in order to win that fight. People in this country are not. They've really not got their heads around this at all.
Let's just wind up this look at Ukraine on this aspect of it anyway, boy. I mean, what the most likely thing to happen, we're going to see, I would suggest, is the shooting down by the Russians of US Navy aircraft that are actually reconnaissance planes, electronic warfare planes, etc., that are helping coordinate these attacks, because they've pointed out that at the time of the missile attack earlier today, this lunchtime, US Navy Boeing P-8A Poseidon reconnaissance aircraft was in the area of the Black Sea close, circling the area for 2 days prior to the attack. And what they've said is that there was a pre-attack yesterday where they were looking at how the Russians were going to defend themselves, and then they sent another one. There's also aircraft of this type are regularly stationed off the Crimean coast, very close, along with RQ-4 Global Hawk high-altitude reconnaissance aircraft and US Air Force E-3A Sentry, that's the 707s with the big dish on the top, long-range radar detection aircraft. Well, they're not just long-range radar detection. They are early warning and control aircraft. So they that's where these attacks are being coordinated. I would suggest to you that anyone is flying in one of those things better be prepared to get it shot down by Russia.
Well, I would agree with you, but I think the Russians, if they decide to retaliate for this sort of thing, aren't going to go for a tit-for-tat approach. They're not going to shoot down an AWACS. They're going to go after the command and control of the other side, and they're going to do it. This is my assessment. I don't know what their thinking is, but if I was them, this is how I would do it. You carry on soaking it up. You give them general warnings about not doing these things, and you give them the warning, say, at some point we're going to react, but we're not going to tell you what we're going to do. And what I would do if I was them is, when you react, you don't just shoot down an AWACS. You attack the bases where they're all coming from. Ramstein, you could attack bases in Britain, the army headquarters at Catterick and so on. And you hit them with the hypersonic missiles that the Russians have got. And the West hasn't got anything like that to fire back. Anything they fire back will be shot down by the Russian air defence. Their stuff can't be shot down. And what they could do is just make an example. But I think they realise that will get it's like punching somebody in the head. It will just get NATO going without causing them serious damage. If we're going to retaliate, we're going to go straight for the jugular, and we're going to bite straight through it, because there'll be no way that the West could respond. They'll also attack in the United States. It's quite possible for the Russians to attack military targets in the United States within 25 minutes. And they could kill hundreds, possibly thousands of soldiers and sailors and airmen. And the West wouldn't actually have a response apart from nuclear weapons.
So let's have a listen now to, it was from one of the trade unions based down in Lugansk a few weeks ago. I'm doing a little series of these, I think, and this one is number two, Donbass Voices. And this is a Donbass voice. This is obviously, looking at the people that we're not hearing anything from, which is the residents of that southeastern region, the Donbass, Crimea, and Lugansk, and Donetsk, in southeastern Ukraine, which all this fighting apparently is all about. And what have they got to say about it? These are the people that have voted in referendums to join the Russian Federation, or referenda, I should say. So let's have a listen now to Dr. Irie Bell, or Irie, I think is probably a more correct pronunciation. And I asked her, what was Ukraine like before 2014?
It was calm before 2014. It was calm country and very prosperous country.
So what was life like back in at home after May 2014?
When disturbances and violations started, in all areas of Ukraine, the protests started violation, military troops trained by NATO, because I know it, and they started to protest. They started a big, massive attack against the region where Russians were lived.
And wasn't there then an agreement, the Minsk agreement, for peace?
Yeah. But it didn't help. So the peace didn't start, and there was agreement, but nobody keep their promises.
Okay, well, at this point you decided to leave. What happened to the rest of your family?
They still live in Donetsk.
So what was life like for them?
Terrible. They are really like crazy now. They have really big psychological problems. And because from 2014 till now, war never stopped. Until now, it's bombing, shelling. They really scared to go on street. They're sitting in their homes and they're still alive. What can I say? They can't leave because my cousin very ill and just lying in the bed, and they can't leave the country.
So what do you make of the Russian invasion?
So when it happened 2 years ago, 2 years ago, Russian invasion, not now, not in 2014. Russian invasion only started to be in 2 years ago. And just they started to invade the Ukrainian part from Donetsk region. Yeah, I know. And war, it's terrible. War, it's never have the human face. And really, just I can't say anything to defend this aggressive action from Russian territory. But the people who live in Donetsk, they feel themselves Russian. They already have all the Russian passports, all of them. And I have plenty of friends there. They are working in hospitals, servicing the injured and wounded people, because I was medical doctor when I was living there as well. And really, they are like crazy. They are really scared about everything. My sister was saying that Ira, don't just intervene in this because it's really political battle mainly, and it's really scared to be every day there.
Yeah, so that is Dr. Iri Bell. She's actually working now in London, a medical doctor trained in the Donbass. Martin, what do you think about what she had to say there? I mean, it's obviously been absolute hell for the people in that part of the world, but she's basically saying, well, the Russians kind of had to come in, really, because they've slowly but surely begun to stabilize that area, which where the Ukrainian from people from Kiev, the Ukrainian army, have been shelling them.
Well, that's right. And if you think about it, when the Russian army intervened in the Ukraine in 2022, the West was saying that it was unprovoked, that there was no reason for it, and that it was just cussed Russians being you know, barbaric and all the rest of it. But then subsequently we get from Merkel and Hollande, who signed the Minsk agreements, they openly came out and said that in actual fact we signed them knowing that we weren't going to keep to the deal, and that in actual fact we were going to build up the Ukrainian forces to win back the whole of the breakaway republics and the Crimea. So they've came out and said that. So, and they also said that and what you can actually see now at this moment, anybody objectively looking at this, it's the Ukrainians who are attacking the breakaway republics, isn't it? The Russian army is defending the breakaway republics, and they are being attacked by the Ukrainians. And at the time in 2022, it was being suggested that the Russians had intervened because for no reason at all. The reason they intervened is because the Ukrainians have been building their forces up outside the Donbass and the breakaway republics in order to invade them. And it's quite clear that that was the plan all along. Nobody can dispute that. That was the plan all along. Lavrov did a very good speech at the United Nations the other day about all of this when he went through the whole thing. The Western narrative about all of this is blatantly lies from the very beginning.
Martin, the discussions at the United Nations General Assembly in New York are always interesting because the Americans cheekily do their best to actually stop some countries coming there, even though it's supposed to be the United Nations headquarters. I do wonder why on earth they bother to have it in the United States, since they're so much of a basically warmongering protagonists around the world. It's almost like having a United Nations based in Nazi Germany in World War II. You know, anyway, look, I would like to pull out, there's loads of interesting stuff going on at the UN right now with the General Assembly going on, but I pulled out one particular speech from President Alexander Vučić, and I'm over in the Balkans at the moment. So here he is, and he is the President of Serbia giving his speech to the UN this week.
They said that the issue of Kosovo is a democratic issue, and that it would be resolved in accordance with the UN Charter and other international law documents. And then, contrary to all, but absolutely all documents of the international public law, it occurred to them in 2008 to support the independence of the so-called Kosovo. The illegal decision on secession of the autonomous province of Kosovo and Metohija from Serbia was made a decade after the war conflict in our country had ended, without a referendum or any other democratic form for declaring their stances for the citizens of Serbia, or at least in Kosovo itself. This decision was made in a moment when Serbia had a government committed to European and Euro-Atlantic integration, and when including in its composition the province of Kosovo and Metohija, a full-fledged member of the UN, but also of Council of Europe, OSCE, and many other international organizations. Nevertheless, it did not prevent legal and political violence coming from those who are today at the forefront in lecturing from this place. Pointless and meaningless explanations like police terror the Serbian authorities had carried out in its southern province a decade earlier, humanitarian crisis, expelling of the local Albanian population, were only a drop that spilled over the glass of lies and nonsense in order to justify the violence against a sovereign country and in order to undermine its integrity. Namely, since the moment of the victory of those 19 against small Serbia, 70% of Serbs from Kosovo have left their thresholds, and there are by 300,000 Albanians more than have ever been in Kosovo. Well, that much about the law, that much about the justice. Nevertheless, worse than anything is that all those who committed aggression against the Republic of Serbia lecture today about territorial integrity of Ukraine, as if we did not support the integrity of Ukraine. And we do support it, and we will keep supporting it, because we do not change our politics, we do not change our principles, regardless of centuries-long traditional friendship with the Russian Federation. To us, every violence is the same, every violation of the UN Charter is the same, regardless of the strength of the power that exerts it, or inevitably similar excuses makes for its illegal and immoral behavior. But when we ask them about the territorial integrity of the Republic of Serbia and about what they had done to my country, the answer is the one that all of you representatives of smaller countries in the world heard on countless of occasions. Do not go back in the past. Look towards the future, because it is the only way for your country to make progress. When it comes to the territorial integrity of Ukraine and Serbia and any other country, all of us are entitled to speak about from this podium at least a bit more than they are. I'm the president of Serbia in my second presidential term. On countless of occasions, I was under different political pressures, and I'm a political veteran. And what I will tell you today is the most important for me. Principles do not change from one circumstance to another. Principles do not apply only on the strong ones. They apply to all. If that's not the case, then there are no longer principles. And that is why I believe that in the modern world, there will either be principles and the same rules will apply to all, or as the world, we will end up in the deepest divisions in our history, in the most difficult conflicts and in problems we will not manage to cope with.
So that's Serbian President Alexander Vučić, I hope I pronounced that right, Alexander, making some really interesting points, I thought, Martin. It's interesting, I think, the divide here is largely to do with the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church. It seems to be that, you know, the Serbians are more Orthodox, the Croatians and Montenegro are more Catholic, for example. Bizarre that this seems to be that borderline, you know, that there's this kind of religious element to this borderline. But the point is very important, isn't it, that can't go on about, oh, forget about Kosovo, they're just a separate republic, just forget about it all. And he's saying, well, yeah, but you're not forgetting about the breakaway part of Ukraine, are you?
No, and I think that's a well-made point, is it not? The West, when it suits its book, is quite happy for people to break away using violence. The Kosovo Liberation Army was a classic terrorist organisation. There I am using the word. But they basically killed lots of civilians and terrorised the non-Albanian population. But it worked, and they got an independent state out of it.
I know you know quite a lot about this, but the Kosovo Liberation Army actually deliberately targeted police stations and government offices with gun attacks, and that's an obvious way to wind up the Serbs.
Well, it is, and if you think about the whole of the Yugoslav situation, the Slovenian National Guard opened fire first on the Yugoslav National Army. So the crisis began when the government of Slovenia, which is a tiny republic in the very north of Yugoslavia, voted for independence from Yugoslavia. Now, there was, in theory, under the constitution, each of these republics could vote for independence. But, of course, you then get down to the situation where Kosovo had always been part of Serbia. So then, you know, there's a question about whether they are allowed to vote for independence, because they were an autonomous region within Serbia, and they were only made an autonomous region in the 1970s by Tito in order to try and curb Serb nationalism, because Yugoslavia was quite a complex, a bit like Lebanon. It's quite a complex interplay of different ethnic groups, but the West encouraged in every way the breakaways in Yugoslavia. So Slovenia broke away, and they started the fighting. The Yugoslav National Army intervened in Slovenia, not to put them down, but just to seal the border so that they could have a serious discussion with the Slovenians about what the way forward might be.
Well, I mean, I'd just like to say something about, you know, being here in Croatia. Croatia did, I mean, it's actually, I was chatting to one of the sort of touristy girls yesterday about it. She said, oh, yeah, we started it. You know, she was, like, looking a bit glum, but it was Croatia that wanted to secede from
the Croatians copied the Slovenians,
yeah,
and of course what was really problematic was that Bosnia did not want to leave Yugoslavia, but they were then put under pressure because the West was recognizing breakaway republics. Everybody's then, if we don't try and break away, we're going to be stuck in a rump Yugoslavia dominated by Serbia. So that then create, and the West deliberately destabilised the whole of Yugoslavia.
As I'm over here, it'd be nice to talk about it a bit, because you can definitely tell, chatting with the older people who live here, maybe, you know, sort of 40 and over, 35 and over, that there is a definite nostalgia for the days of the former Yugoslavia, where things were a lot easier. In fact, one of the weird things that you see going around the coast here is all these like half-built or derelict hotels, which were either half-built or actually fully built, but then somehow abandoned because they weren't part of the new system. It's almost like you've got these kind of NATO hotels that have grown up ever since the war, and some of these older legacy ones, including some of Tito's old villas. Also, a lot of the industry, and one of the things that they said in the Dubrovnik Museum about the old Yugoslavia was that there was a tremendous amount of industry around this part of the country, and each of the factories were producing, say, something for maybe a part, one of the parts for the cars, I don't know, the bumpers or whatever, and there was always worker-controlled industries around, and that all went, and now the main industry is just tourism. So it's almost as if it's been kind of decapitated as an industrial force, and the sort of country that might ever be able to kind of look after itself, wage war. The other thing is fascinating is this kind of dispute that there was between Stalin and Tito in 1948. They make quite a lot of that, saying, well, actually, we really did militarily stand up to Stalin, and he backed down, basically, so that they had a very independent form of socialism here, or communism, which, although they did have their secret police and that sort of thing, generally there was a lot more freedoms here than there was in the Soviet Union.
That's true. And what's interesting about Yugoslavia is because it's actually very, Slovenia was the most developed republic, Kosovo was the most underdeveloped. So Slovenia is basically a West European country, and Kosovo is more like a third world country, and you've got everything in between in the various other republics in Yugoslavia. So this was quite a tricky thing for the communist regime to manage, and they were basically transferring resources from more developed republics to the less developed republics as part of an integration strategy to try and bring all these people together under one roof, as it were. But it was always going to be tricky. And one of the things they did, because they were outside the Eastern Bloc, is in order to preserve what they were doing, they started borrowing money from the Western banks. Money from the Western banks then get their claws in, and they force them to do various things, which ultimately lead to the breakup of the country.
After 1980 and the death of Tito, that's what they were doing, and that was the beginning of the end. Anyway, just to finish our international section now, back to Ukraine, I suppose it has to be, because good old King Charles III has been over in France making big speeches to, I don't know if any of the senators are looking at, doing to him what they did to their monarchy. Maybe not, because he's saying apparently what they want to hear over Ukraine and also about the environment. So let's have a listen to King Charles speaking yesterday to the Senate.
When General de Gaulle spoke to the French people from London in June of 1940, he said, "Remember this, France does not stand alone. She is not isolated. She can make common cause with the British." De Gaulle's confidence in our alliance was well founded. 2 days before the Appel du 18 juin, Sir Winston Churchill's government had offered France an indissoluble political union, which would have allowed our two peoples to continue the fight for justice and freedom as a single country. Just 2 months after that historic broadcast, my grandfather, King George VI, proudly wearing the crimson ribbon of the Légion d'Honneur, joined de Gaulle at Morville Camp near Aldershot to inspect 2,500 of the Free French troops. The common determination expressed that day sustained us through the long and bitter years of that war, and drove us forward together to victory. Aujourd'hui,
today, more than 80 years after we were fighting side by side for the liberation of Europe, we are once again up against an unjustified attack on our continent. Our determination and our alliance are more important than ever. Together we shall stand by the people of Ukraine with determined solidarity. Together we shall not move. Our determination shall not be moved. Ukraine will triumph, and our cherished freedom will prevail.
These horrifying events have once more demonstrated the fragility of so much that we hold dear. Just as we stand together against military aggression, so must we strive together to protect the world from our most existential challenge of all, that of global warming, climate change, and the catastrophic destruction of nature.
Well, that's a twisted load of cobblers, if ever I heard it. First of all, he's talking about the French and the British winning the Second World War. I don't know if he counted the 30 million or so of the Soviet Union, and mostly Russians, who died defeating Hitler. Apparently, he's forgotten all about that. And then he's also saying that global warming is far more of a threat than nuclear war, Martin.
Well, it is. I mean, it is just sickening, isn't it? The hypocrisy of it all is beyond belief. But there you are, people. You know, this kind of drivel is based upon the misunderstanding of Second World War history, which is quite common in this country. The idea that we won the war, you know, and that Britain was victorious. Britain played its part, but it was a fairly minor part compared to what the Soviet Union did. The Soviet Union also defeated the Japanese in Manchuria. It took them about a week to smash the Japanese army, whereas the Americans had taken ages to get to the position they were in. And they were about to invade Japan. And as I understand it, the stuff I've been reading recently, the Japanese wanted to surrender to the West because they feared that they were about to be overrun by the Soviet Union. And the West said, no, you can't surrender until we've used our nuclear weapons on you so that the Soviet Union can see what we've got in the locker here. All of which is shows the cynicism of all of this.
Add a little bit of pepper to your soup there and say, and actually both of those nuclear weapons, it looks likely that they used Nazi-enriched uranium and Nazi-plutonium fuses in order to actually blow those bombs up. So it was really a deal made in hell with the Nazis that enabled the Americans to use those bombs in the first place. I mean, I would love to have gotten into the nuclear thing. We'll have to do it next week, looking at the Devonport nuclear safety lecture from John Large, who's now sadly no longer with us, but it's an old recording that I've dug out. Fascinating look at the danger there is for people who live in Plymouth, actually in Devonport itself, because of the failures of the various scenarios for accidents that they've looked at there. Plus a look at the Palomares incident with a reporter from France 24 going over now to look at this massive amount of plutonium, americium and all sorts of other actinoids contaminated land that's left after the Americans accidentally dropped and exploded two nuclear weapons, H-bombs, on the soil of Spain when they had one of their planes had a refueling incident. They had this maniacal idea in those days that they had to keep these B-52 bombers with loads of nukes in the air all the time in order to frighten the Russians. So that happened back in 1966. So we'll be looking at that and also a look at the atomic test veterans here in the UK. But we'll wind up tonight with my great, I'm a big, big fan of hers. I've become a fan over the last few weeks, Morgan Marshall. She's at It's Morgan FR on TikTok. And we'll wind up this week with her look at heaven and hell. And maybe you can just stay with us, Martin, to see what you make of this analysis. I think it's quite interesting to see that she picks up on somebody called Dolores Cannon, and her book is called The Three Waves of The Three Waves of Volunteers, she calls it. But it's also a look at the spiritual and the difference between heaven and hell. So let's wind up with that now. Morgan Marshall, TikTok star.
And the new earth separates, and it will be totally new and beautiful.
Okay, definitely go back and watch that whole video because I'm about to blow your mind. Someone sent me that clip. I'll tag them in the comments. But that is Dolores Cannon. If you have read any of her books, you know that she is a past life regressionist, which means that she hypnotizes people into their subconscious state so she can have conversations with Source and get answers about the universe. Really cool thing about it is that they all say something similar. So how could everybody's subconscious come up with the same answers if they weren't somehow connected? I've read her book, The Three Waves of Volunteers, and it was super interesting and completely changed my perspective on life. But the reason that I'm making this video is because I think that what she's talking about in that clip is exactly what the Bible is explaining. She said that the earth is splitting into two dimensions, one being a higher vibration and one being a lower vibration. She says to get into the higher vibration dimension, you have to raise your own vibration or else you'll be stuck in the lower vibration dimension when the split happens. Lower dimension will be full of hate, fear, and chaos, with the higher dimension being purely love and light. I think that the higher dimension will be heaven and the lower dimension will be hell. The way that you get into the higher dimension is by getting right with God, aka raising your consciousness and only operating purely out of love and light. If you only operate out of your ego and do things solely for the purpose of pleasing yourself, you're going to be stuck in the lower dimension that vibrates at that same frequency. To raise your vibration, you have to practice love and acceptance. Here's a chart showing the range of emotions and frequency. These are the higher frequency emotions and these are the lower frequency emotions. You want to be up here operating out of enlightenment, peace, joy, and love. You keep holding on to your past and you're afraid of the future and you have the just my luck mentality, then you're probably operating out of these lower vibrations. To change that and raise your vibration, you have to train your mind to not care what others think and to love yourself and accept others for who they are. you have to realize that everything happens for a reason, and just because an unwanted event happens to you doesn't mean that you should dwell on it and feed into that negative energy. God works in mysterious ways, and if all we had were positive experiences, we would never learn and grow. That's why it's Satan's plan to keep us all living in fear of the future and operating at lower vibrations. And that's why the world is so chaotic, but I make these videos so that you guys can recognize the plan and not be afraid of it, because once you understand that the whole goal is to keep us operating at a lower vibrational frequency and living in this lower vibrational hell, then we can finally break free. This is all biblical, and everything is going to be okay. Don't feed into the negativity and be afraid of the future, because that is exactly what they want, to keep you operating at this lower vibrational frequency. And to be clear, I do believe in Jesus. I think that through God, he reached the highest level of enlightenment, and because of that, he was able to manifest anything that he wanted in real time, and that's why he was able to perform all the miracles and heal everybody like he did. God created Jesus to show us our true potential as humans, and that's why we should all follow his ways of selflessness and love, so that we can raise the collective consciousness vibration and leave this whole NWO BS behind. Just so everyone knows, this is spirituality, not Christianity. I think that religion is just another way to divide us and keep us disagreeing with each other. I'm not here to push my Christian beliefs on you, because you don't have to be Christian to believe in the Bible and Jesus.
Well, there you go, Morgan Marshall. God bless you, and what a fantastic, I think, an interesting job. She's a bit Russell Brand, I think, in a way, looking at this thing about vibrations, Martin. I know you don't really believe in a lot of this stuff, but what do you make of that?
Well, you're right that I don't believe in all of that stuff. I mean, a lot of it is actually just, you know, it's just, it's not very revealing, is it? People should be nice to each other. I agree. People shouldn't be nasty to each other. I agree. Some people believe in Jesus. Okay, I'm perfectly happy with that. But the idea that there's some kind of mystical revelation seems a bit bizarre. It's pretty commonplace stuff, isn't it? It's just what you'd expect people to say. They're not in favour of bad things, they're in favour of good things. I'm in favour of good things too, but that's not really an analysis, is it?
Well, it is, in a way, that there is this other spiritual dimension, and I think there's plenty of people out there that understand that and believe it, and that we're actually part of something bigger. I think one of the ways that we're isolated as individuals is, well, it's just you know, and you're not really connected up. I think that in many ways people are connected up to these much bigger, higher forces, and if you go to the beginning of the podcast, you'll hear Dennis Wheatley talking about such things. Anyway, thanks very much, Martin, and also, of course, to sound engineer Dave Pazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and you can also follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram if you wish. Do please send me interviews, and you can also send story links on comment on our comment page, and you've got Martin and I's email addresses at our show page at thisweekoneword.org.uk. So we'll be doing the news next week, hopefully, inshallah, back in the UK. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join Not the Big CFM Politics Show, talkradio.org.uk live stream next Friday. Hopefully you'll be sitting there in the studio, you might be able to hear me a bit better. God bless, and God bless Morgan Marshall too, and don't let those satanic banksters get you down.